The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
7:30 on this Thursday morning. You're very welcome along to OTB AM. It is Owen and Kieran Donaghy with you right the way through until 9:30 this morning. We've got Kenny Cunningham, we've got Brian O'Driscoll, we've got Dermot Corrigan, all to come between now and then, so it is a packed morning. We'd love to hear your thoughts, especially on the Champions League this morning. At Off the Ball is how you get in touch on Twitter, or just comment on the stream below if you're with us on Facebook or on YouTube this morning. Kieran, what's the crack?
How are you, man?
Are you looking at Sergio Ramos last night thinking, that's how you do it, that is how you go down in style? 26 red cards, my man.
Yeah, I thought he was unlucky, I'll be honest. I thought if they looked at it in VAR...
That's the most Kieran Donaghy take I've ever heard.
No, I he did put his hands around him, but he kind of, I don't know how much of a pullback there was. I thought he was trying to get out of the way. Everything would tell you in your fibre that it was a straight red. And I wouldn't blame the referee at all for straight red, and of course there's an argument for it, but I think if they'd have went back and looked at the VAR, I thought Jesus threw himself down pretty easy. He knew what he was doing. Not greedy enough too. Thought he had a chance for a goal if he'd have just kept going, because Ramos didn't touch him. Actually didn't touch him. No, unless there was some clicking of their heels, but definitely upper body wise, it looked like Ramos might have got him, but I actually don't think he did. So, but Ramos did the right thing. You know, he had to take that a 3-1 deficit heading to the Etihad in a few weeks would not be good for Madrid. Whereas a 2-1 on a good day, they can score 2 goals, so you know, they could look for an extra time over there. So yeah, he probably saved his team, but yeah. Yeah, you have to love the bit of dirt about him.
Yeah, you do. With the players they have, absolutely, it's the right thing to do, because you'll always give yourself a chance of scoring a couple of goals over there the next day. Like this was a really interesting one last night, because for the first 20-30 minutes, you're like, well, this is kind of actually quite boring, until you realise what's actually happening, and you're like, you start to realise the patterns that are emerging, and you're like, Gabriel Jesus should not be in that part of the pitch, and you start to realise that actually 4-4-2 from Pep Guardiola, I don't know, has he been spending a little bit too much time playing Sean Dyche teams or something like that in the Premier League, but there was a novelty to it, and you kind of felt that it was just this stick of dynamite that was waiting to explode at some point, and in the second half, things just got a little bit chaotic.
Yeah, he's probably lucky he got the result. He probably would have been ridiculed if they'd have lost 1-0 last night. But having said that, they had a period there from like 55 to like 65 right before Madrid scored, where they were
really on top.
Really on top, and really looked to know what they were about too. But yeah, inside the last 15 minutes, they looked like they were pretty comfortable. Once they got that bit of goal, once they got the goal, I think they got a huge amount of belief. And I think every fella, you know, drove on a small bit and felt like that they could get this result. So Sterling knew what he was doing for the penalty as well. Danny Carvajal should never dive in. Like, you can't, no. Just can't dive in. Not against someone as quick as Sterling. You put him towards the end line, and if he pulls one back and they get a goal, grand. But you're giving out a 9 out of 10 when you take him down for the penalty. Like, you know, they're going to miss 1 out of 10 of them. Whereas if they put it across, there's a number of things that can happen there to bail Madrid out. But inexperienced about him. Do you remember the time he was at the County League game in?
Oh, yeah.
In Clarglen?
Completely forgot about that.
So maybe he saw Peter Crowley doing something that day that led him to dive in like that. But no, he was just randomly standing at the sideline of a County League game in Kerry. I think his girlfriend was over on work placement or something like that in Clarglen. So it was one of the rarest sightings of the GAA game. I think you'd see a two-time Champions League winner just standing on the hill in Clarglen underneath the trees trying to protect himself from the cold watching this crazy game.
Jesus, one of the forgotten stories, Danny Carvajal. Oh my God, I completely forgot about that. We must get a couple of images of those as the morning goes on. Like, I don't know, the other kind of thing last night, and we'll get into this with Kenny Cunningham later on.
Yeah.
Kevin De Bruyne, like, you just can't say enough about the guy. The playing in a different position again last night, controlled the game, and I thought that my take on it was that even if Manchester City had come away with a defeat last night, it's like, well, you still have so much good things to say about Kevin De Bruyne, and he would never have been the person who would have taken the brunt of it, whereas now that they've won, he actually is the hero of the night. But it just kind of crystallises Real Madrid not starting Toni Kroos last night, and it's like, what a midfield player can do in a Champions League game when A, things are actually a bit of a slog at the start of a 180 minute clash, they just pass the ball around and give you the tempo that they require, or when things get chaotic as they tend to do in the Champions League nowadays, they actually can also kind of substitute back in that sense of calm that is required and that Kevin De Bruyne brought last night. So, God, I don't know.
He's got great legs as well, yeah. though, De Bruyne. He's got all the passing, which is, you know, which is a part of it, to have that ability to pass the ball. But really, when you actually watch him get around the pitch, honest to God, you're another former Chelsea man. We have a team of Chelsea rejects that would probably win the Champions League by themselves. If you throw in Mo Salah and Cuadrado again last night, looked pretty good at times. Mm. But he's different class, really. He's probably the best crosser, passer in the Premiership, if not Europe. And he's got that burst of pace too, that when he gets out in open space and he gets those legs moving, I wouldn't say he's explosive off the start, but once he gets into stride, a bit like Gerrard in his prime, you know, you didn't think he was overly quick, but once he got into stride, he'd leave fellas for dead. So he's got that ability, and what a strike of a ball off both legs. He had a crack with his left leg last night, if you remember, coming at the edge of the box, and when the Real Madrid lads blocked it, but you know, that would have probably flown into the top corner the way he hit it. So yeah, he's special talent.
Yeah, plenty to discuss. We'll get into that with Kenny Cunningham later on. If you missed it, it was a second half header from Gabriel Jesus and De Bruyne, a penalty which turned the games in City's favour. Real took the lead through Isco, a complete cock up at the back for Manchester City, a double error really from them. Sergio Ramos, as we said, showing a late red card in last night's game. That is his 26th career red card. Quite an incredible statistic. The other game last night was Juventus going down 1-0 to Lyon in the other Champions League tie. Had it on Jules Green, didn't look like Juventus created a whole pile except for one or two early chances. So Lyon full value for their lead in that one. The football continues tonight. Manchester United, Arsenal, Wolves, Celtic all in action, hoping to join Rangers in the Europa League last 16. Their game went ahead early last night and they qualified against Braga. Wolves are up 4-0 against Espanyol. It's 1-1 between Manchester United and Club Brugge. Arsenal lead Olympiacos 1-0, and Celtic and Copenhagen are tied 1-1. In the rugby, Six Nations and IRFU officials holding further discussions as to when to hold the postponed Ireland-Italy match, called off yesterday due to the threat of the coronavirus. So of course, Rugby World Cup at the start of this year compresses the season back further. Only two tests against Australia this summer though. I wonder, does that open up a little patch in the calendar? Either way, it's going to be a tricky thing to fit in. It could be a situation like 2001 now, where it is going to be after the summer when this game gets played, but it's still very much to be confirmed. You'd wonder as well, if the virus continues to spread, is the Paris game definitely going to go ahead? There's been no suggestion, I should say, that this game is under threat at the moment, but I'm just saying that
But sport fixtures in general.
Yeah, absolutely.
If it continues to spread, you know, you have to look at soccer games, look at Champions League, European League.
Mad how Juventus fans were allowed to travel to Lyon last night, actually, when you think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
In Gaelic games, Austin Stack Park in Tralee will host next week's Airgrid Munster under-20 football final. Kerry are into the provincial decider. They won 14-7 over Limerick and Rathkeel last night. Cork 1-12-2-7 victories over Clare in Milltown Malbay. And then in racing, there's a 7-race car at Clonmel this afternoon, the first going to post at 2 o'clock. Let's tell you what's coming up this morning. Kenny Cunningham is going to be with us in just a moment. The top 5 stories coming your way at 8 o'clock. Brian O'Driscoll then has been in studio chatting about the disaster at Twickenham. That's coming your way at 8:15 this morning. The sports news with Stephen Doyle. He's in the house to give a bit of abuse to two Kerry men here this morning, I think, especially. Dermot Corrigan then at 10-9. Getting stuck into Barcelona as well as Real Madrid last night, because it is El Clásico, of course, this Sunday night. Sports documentaries then at 9:10. Kieran is the subject of one. We'll get his thoughts on his favourite sports documentary. So that's the agenda between now and 9:30. If you've got any thoughts whatsoever, you can tweet us at Off the Ball. Time for the sports pages. OTB AM. We will start with offtheball.com, and it is Jarlath Burns' story there leading the way. He was on Off the Ball last night ahead of his tilt at becoming GAA president this weekend at Congress. County players will only train Wednesdays and Fridays. We will get into that in just a moment, but a couple of the other stories. Ronan O'Gara also on. He was talking about Johnny Sexton as Ireland captain. I wasn't a fan of it from day one, he says. While young footballers expect in-depth analysis of their matches, says Brian Kerr. You've also got a bit more from David Brady and Damien Delaney on how technology helped improve his game. Offtheball.com if you want any further details on those stories. The Irish Times then. De Bruyne on the spot to put City in the driving seat. A picture of Danny Carvajal fouling Raheem Sterling there, as Kieran mentioned. It's David Heitner reporting at the Bernabeu. Guardiola's side come from behind to secure a previous away win Precious away win, I should say, in Madrid. Guardiola and defiant City come to the belly of the beast and prevail, writes Barney Ronay. Former Barcelona manager returns to conquer at the home of his old adversaries. So it is Manchester City against Real Madrid all the way this morning.
The Irish Daily Star, hijinks for City. And yeah, a bit of a scary story down below. Don't panic. Cheltenham officials confident for festival. So that'd be a disaster if Cheltenham ended up being called off if there was cases started breaking out in the UK and Ireland. So let's keep touch wood that it stays away from us.
Yeah, you just don't know at this point, given how quickly it's it seems to have spread in northern Italy. Yeah, exactly. The back page of the London Times is, that's what Europe will be missing. Superb City shock Real in first game since UEFA's two-year ban. Definitely gave them an extra bit of a boost, I thought, yesterday, the fact that it was their first European game since the announcement that they would be banned for 2 years.
What about if they win the Champions League?
I presume that wouldn't be any sort of circumstance whatsoever. Like, you can't just change because they're good at football.
No, but I'm saying, like, they're kind of gone. They can't qualify for the next two European competitions. But if you win, you automatically qualify. Does that...
No, I would say that would be an outrageous loophole. They're like, yeah, we are going to just completely suspend our rules that we've implemented because you're better than everybody else in Europe.
That's the automatic thing for winning it, though. Like,
to be honest with you, I don't know if it says that in the small print, but I would be astonished if that was if they were like
just throwing it out there.
No, we're going to uphold the ban except if you win the Champions League. The other story here is Six Nations finale facing lengthy delay. It is coronavirus, and pretty much all the back pages this morning.
Yeah, the Herald Sport, City's real steal. So, you know, they're making out like they stole the game last night at the Bernabeu, so I wouldn't actually say that. And who can take on the Dubs in Leinster? Graham Geraghty there saying Meath facing a relegation battle. So he's not confident that they can beat the Dubs in Leinster, I presume.
The Daily Telegraph goes with the real deal. City show Champions League class with historic victory in Bernabeu. De Bruyne penalty seals comeback win before Ramos is sent off. We've also got Maria Sharapova. Her sad goodbye, Brian's tragic death, catalyst to quitting. She said, captain roots log, keeping diary, makes me a better leader, and Six Nations hit. Ireland game off, England the next, they ask. Of course, England also have to play Italy.
The Independent is Six Nations hangs in the balance. Spread of carnivorous virus in Europe ensures further tournament disruption is inevitable. So yeah, that goes back to what you said there a minute ago on about maybe the French game hanging in the balance and Doris aiming for another day in green. So yeah, we'll hope he gets his day at number 8 because it was very tough for him to start his first game and for 4 minutes later to be concussed. It's an absolute killer.
The Guardian is City's prayers answered by Jesus and De Bruyne. Late comeback turns tie on its head after Guardiola's spring surprise with selection. Coronavirus concerns, meanwhile. Major sporting events at risk of cancellation as outbreak spreads. And Wilder's costume drama. Sports writer of the year Marina Hyde and the boxer's preposterous excuse in defeat. What's the worst excuse you've ever encountered in a sporting environment? Anything as bad as a 40-pound costume?
I tell you, 40 pounds is heavy. No, honest to God.
Beyonce Wilder sympathiser here.
No, I'm not a sympathiser at all, but I tell you, if you walked the length that he walked and that your legs, you would be fairly tired. Like he's a heavyweight champion, so, you know, and plus you put that on inside in the dressing room, you realise quick enough that this is heavy. I'm not wearing it down to the ring, but again, it might have been a bit of style over substance with him. The ring walks were big the last night.
Yeah.
Bring back the real big ring walks, yeah?
The longer ones.
The longer ones and more hype and...
Yeah. Did you go full WWE, like in the dressing room beforehand, actually watching the other person's ring watching the...
Eubank and Collins in Mill Street, like in Harley Davidson's and all that, like, yeah.
They actually just need to bring the two boys to Mill Street to give them a proper ring walk.
The Irish Examiner City salute. Advantage Sky Blues as De Bruyne penalty rocks Real Madrid. And at the top of the page... Kerry and Cork back at it again next week in a Munster under 20 final. So a good win against a tough Limerick side for John Shukru's crew last night. A few stacks boys on the score sheet. Sean Quilter, a point after a big day for the Green against the Sim as well last week.
Oh yeah. It's all coming
are
up.
They around the matter, are
yeah,
they?
We won't say too much about that. A very disappointing day for the old school.
Was it, yeah?
Yeah, but sure.
He got us in the two before it, but it was a cracking game though the last day.
By all accounts, it was.
Absolutely unbelievable. Green went 9 points up, playing unbelievable. The Sim came out in the second half and kicked 8 straight points in a row to bring it back within one. And yeah, the green kind of rallied it back, but excellent game of football. Schools football, 4-15 to 1-14 or something, yeah, like that. So yeah, belter of a game.
The Irish Daily Mail this morning goes with pandemonium. Irish teams face postponements as virus spread. Picture there of Mendy, Mahrez and De Bruyne celebrating. City the real deal. And restless Davy Fitz says he's always in search of substitute for passion.
The Mirror, again, Six Nations in chaos. So that is a story. One that I don't like in the bottom of the page here is Willian on way out of the bridge. So Willian on course to quit Chelsea in the summer after contract talks with the clubs have collapsed. So I would have thought that Lamps would have kept him as his pointed not to see him on the last night. But
are you worried in general at the moment?
No, I'm not.
Hopeful?
I'm hopeful. I'm positive. A lot of young guys out there, they're up against a really good...
There was only one teenager on the pitch the last night and he didn't play for Chelsea.
Yeah, but like... There's about 5 20-year-olds.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah. Stop being pedantic on about looking for teenagers out there. There's not too many teenagers out in the pitch top Champions League games, though.
The Irish Sun this morning is banned on the run. Kev's star appeal. Virus chaos is their headline in the coronavirus stuff. And Kane boost. Harry Kane targeting a return in early April, which is a big boost for Tottenham Hotspur. And then the Racing Post, lastly... Festival price-wise, Cheltenham confident the show will go on. And back pages, qualified success. Underwhelming United should avoid Europa slip-up. It is Manchester United against Club Brugge at 8 o'clock tonight.
Jeez, if Cheltenham gets called off, there's going to be an awful lot of fellas with a week off work.
Absolutely.
What, sitting there twiddling their thumbs for the week.
I hope it's not. An influx of families coming in. We've got the Manchester Evening News, Berna Blue, report, ratings, reaction, analysis. From the blue side of Manchester, and then Shaw wants a final flourish from the red side of Manchester. We do have Kenny Cunningham standing by. Before that, I should say that Virgin Media have over 400 UEFA Champions League, Europa League and Nations League games live this season. All of these games are available to all Virgin Media TV customers, who can also download the TV Anywhere app and stream the action whenever and wherever they like. Here's Keith Andrews talking last night about what it will be like to work under Pep Guardiola.
Yeah, I think they're clearly very different in their approach to the game. I would have thought Zidane would have been very much in terms of man managing the massive egos. I think that was a big part of his success that he had in his previous tenure at the football club. When you look at Pep, I think the accusation would be if he's not giving Burnley the same amount of respect, players quickly sense that, don't they? That, well, hold on, we're doing so much more. And I know once it gets going, Manchester City will outdo most of the Premier League. But I suppose when it gets to the crunch, that has been one of the criticism levelled at him, the latter stages of Champions League and his record at Champions League level. I don't buy into it. I think it's that competitive of a competition to win. There's no guarantees with it, regardless of how much money you're able to spend.
Would you like to get that amount of information? I think Pep said there he would like, as himself, as a player, to have as much information on opposition as he could.
Yeah, I've been privy to see some of the meetings that he's done at Manchester City, and I don't think it's an overload in the main. I think you need to be careful with how much you throw at players, and I think what you need to do is you need to leave that information for players if they want more than the facilities are there for to come to the coaching staff or the analysts, and I think that undoubtedly will be there.
Keith Andrews there last night on Virgin Media Sport. Kenny Cunningham, a very good morning.
Morning, lads.
Morning, Kenny.
This was pretty fascinating stuff last night, Kenny. When we were watching it, we were eager to actually get your take this morning. I'd say you were salivating over what Pep Guardiola was doing last night. What in his view, in your view, did he do last night? What was the main talking points in terms of how he set up his team?
Oh, it's classic 4-4-2, lads.
It's as simple as that, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it was pretty amazing, really. Yeah, early on in the game, obviously a lot of discussion about his starting 11, but once you decided on that, once you saw the names, immediately you're shuffling the pieces around the board thinking how he's going to set up. Ideally, with those players on the starting 11, lads, you were looking really at a kind of, generally, the way he likes to set his team up, 4-3-3 with Jesus up top, Silva and Mahrez either side, and a midfield three of De Bruyne, Gundogan and Rodri sitting. That's invariably what you'd expect to see, but obviously he changed, he surprised us, and really when it went with a 4-4-2 formation, the decision to put De Bruyne kind of high up the pitch down the middle is probably not the first time he's done. If you think back to the Man United game at Old Trafford not too long ago, previously he played him as kind of that false number 9, lads. But that was in his orthodox 4-3-3 that I was speaking about. So that wouldn't be highly unusual. But they kind of play him up front with Silva kind of in a two. Did surprise me, to be honest with you. Personally, I'd still argue that with those players and in that system, if you're going to play a 4-4-2 system, for me, I still would have flipped Jesus and played him up front with De Bruyne and Bernardo Silva off the left. Because I think De Bruyne, probably the best player on the pitch last night, probably would have dovetailed better with Jesus high up the pitch. Silva and De Bruyne, kind of, I'm sure maybe one of the reasons he played him there was at times to get an overload in midfield. He'd end up with that box shape in midfield with Gundogan and Rodrigo and kind of dominating that central area of the pitch. And maybe we saw that to an extent. I wouldn't say they actually dominated possession. But I still feel at the time they didn't hoard maybe Madrid enough in behind. And with Jesus there, who I'm a huge fan of, I think with him with De Bruyne there, they would have dovetailed better. De Bruyne dropping in, receiving the ball deep. And Jesus, the quality of his runs in behind down the sides of defenders, which there is a small weakness with Madrid with Ramos in particular. I actually thought they let them off the hook a little bit by playing as they did. Jesus played great on the left wing, don't get me wrong. He was up and down, tracking people. The defensive side of his game was great, and he still offered an attacking threat from that left wing position, driving on the inside. But I think we saw, lads, when Jesus went into his preferred central position in the second half, when Sterling came on, he carried it even more of a threat and had more of an impact on the game. So, yeah, I'm sure Guardiola will be getting a lot of kind of claps on the back, and this is amazing. And he's got a lot of courage to make this kind of call in such a game as important and as crucial to Manchester City. But for me, by actually shuffling the pieces a little bit more on the pitch, they could have been even more effective than they were.
Yeah, like that's a great point, because I was actually going to be devil's advocate there until you actually made that exact point. Like, they were 1-0 down playing this game. Like, this pragmatic approach was fantastic, and there's a novelty to it, and it was unbelievably intriguing to see. But they still went 1-0 down, and it was only when the game opened up and they kind of reverted to type that they actually regained the lead. Like, I know that may sound a little bit harsh on what Pep did last night, because I think he does deserve a bit of credit, but that's really what we saw. It was the chaos that they actually thrived in last night.
Yeah, I wouldn't say chaos is too strong, but I thought there was a bit of structure, obviously, to what they were doing. I like the fact maybe Gundogan playing alongside Rodrigo as a pair in central midfield. Now, I think that gave a more solid defensive base in that central area of the pitch. They didn't vacate that area too often, the two Manchester City central midfield players. So you kind of make that an argument from a defensive point of view. Did they make themselves a little more secure in there? For me, the biggest question I was really Fernandinho sitting on the bench. I mean, I was speaking about the Chelsea game, you know, I was saying about, like, when Kante's not in the Chelsea team, like, I have heart palpitations, particularly if I was a Chelsea supporter. Well, Fernandinho's the same for Manchester City for me. When he's not on the pitch, particularly at the expense of Otamendi coming into the pitch, that was a strange one for me. Guardiola alluded maybe his question mark about physically a little bit of a drop-off in terms of maybe suffering a little bit because of his age, but I mean, I'd take Fernandinho 60-70% fit ahead of Otamendi 100%. And I think they got away with that when Otamendi caused the fourth goal, played a horrible ball into Rodrigo, got himself caught out of position and cost him the goal. And Fernandinho coming on in that centre-half position at Laporte's expense, particularly second half, maybe they had a bit of a wobble and Real Madrid got the goal. He was outstanding, made two amazing interceptions immediately after the goal and kept him in the game. So that was a big decision before you put the 11 on the pitch. Actually, Fernandinho on the pitch, I thought he took a calculated risk. I didn't see the reasons behind that. You can never make an argument for me with Fernandinho on the bench and not Otamendi on the pitch in any position ahead of that. So I'd certainly question that decision, leaving Fernandinho on the bench. And likewise, they didn't suffer. The Real Madrid team, potentially a couple of years ago at their best, own maybe would have hurt them a lot more than they did last night. This is a Real Madrid team which has lost its kind of its punch. You know, they're suffering kind of one or two areas of the pitch. There's still some individual talent sprinkled around the pitch, but just don't play with that kind of personality, that arrogance that they did some years ago. So actually, Manchester City actually didn't have to be at their best last night, and probably should have made them more comfortable.
Kenny, are players and defenders in particular, are they shunned now by having the old adage of if in doubt, get it out? Because you could see last night when Kyle Walker didn't boot it into the stands, you'd Kevin De Bruyne kind of going after him on the pitch about it. But if he did boot it into the stands and did that consistently, is Pep and the rest of the management kind of saying, listen, let's keep the ball down and let's play the game here a bit?
Yeah, I think you're right, Kieran. Generally speaking, didn't quite think that was the case last night. I thought he'd actually dug on Amendi Walker, to be honest with you. His recovery is very good, Kieran Walker, you know, because of his speed. He gets himself out of jail sometimes. The starting position at times isn't the greatest, gets himself too high. But his recovery position was very good last night. He actually got himself gold side of Vinicius. Just laboured a little bit. I think he might have had that thought process that you're talking about. Didn't think necessarily he had to kick it into the stand. He was almost facing his own goal. Could have easily played it backwards towards his goalkeeper, but you're probably right in terms of this is how they want to play, this is what they want to do. So he's probably thinking, I can have another touch here, you maybe dribble across the pitch myself. And when he was having those thoughts, the ball was stolen off him and ended up in the back of the net. But that'd be pretty kind of typical of a Manchester City. Their big weakness has always been Kieran down that right hand side. Walker and Otamendi in particular, when they play down that side of the pitch, they're always going to give up opportunities. It's always been a weakness in the team, so that was no big surprise. But it was a great response from City. Obviously, the substitutions came, the kind of dynamism of Sterling down the left-hand side, getting an added impetus. And for me, again, like I'll say it again, Jesus, I know a lot of people screaming about Aguero not playing before the game. What's he thinking of him? How can you leave Aguero out of the team? But I think they do this kid a injustice. Kieran Jesus, I don't think people realise how good he is. I think he's absolutely an outstanding player. I don't think there's a big drop off in Manchester City's performances when he plays ahead of Aguero. I mean, his attitude more so than anything else. He's had to play second fiddle to Aguero for a long time, but every time he's on the pitch, Kieran, he impacts the game, whether he starts or whether he comes off the bench. His attitude, his mentality is absolutely fantastic. Scoring goals, creating goals. You saw the defensive side of his game last night. Asked the players, the left winger, no problem, Gaffer. I'll track those runs of Carvajal all day, all long, and they'll still impact the game at the other end. Play centre forward, yeah, no problem, Gaffer. Put me up there as well the last 25 minutes. I'll impact the game as well, which he did. We saw those natural centre forward instincts in terms of getting his first goal. If you watch him, he actually made a quick little dart to the near post when De Bruyne got into the box, didn't receive the ball, and immediately he's on the move again, checking his shoulder, kind of spinning in behind Ramos to get his goal, and then obviously the lead up to Ramos sending off. So he's an outstanding young player, and he's the reason why Manchester City won't have to spend big 100-150 million in the transfer market when Aguero jumps on his private plane and heads back to Buenos Aires in a couple of years.
And when would you when do you think that change comes, where Jesus goes from number two to number one? How long do you think that's going to take him?
I don't think he's far off, Kieran, okay, for the reasons that I said. Honestly, Aguero's always the one. It's a massive game tomorrow, Kieran, with Champions League final. You had to pick a Manchester City team. You put Aguero ahead of him.
Yeah.
But if you were to break it down, Kieran, in terms of, well, why would you actually? Well, why does Aguero go? Why does he play ahead of him? People would throw maybe stats at you in terms of his previous history, goals. Have a look at the amount of goals Aguero scored. But they've actually break their games down, both of them. There's very little between them. You actually argue in terms of mobility and quickness, speed of foot. Actually, Jesus has the advantage over Aguero. There's really not much between them for me. That's a great compliment to Jesus, because Aguero is the best around. And even his performance last night, I think there's an argument really that he's knocking on the door for a position in one of those wide areas. Though I do feel as if, obviously, Sterling and Mahrez for me has been great, probably their best forward the last couple of months playing off the right hand side. So he's just going to have to be patient, probably, even going forward. And he'll get his fair share of the goals. Guardiola has to give him his fair share of the games, because he can't afford to lose that kid in the next year or two, getting too disenchanted, Kieran, not getting enough game time. And I think he rotates it pretty well, Guardiola, in terms of him and Aguero high up the pitch. Got to be careful with Aguero as well with his injury record. So, yeah, funny old game last night, generally speaking. Manchester City with a better team. He did surprise us. But, I still feel as if they let Manchester City Ramage it off the hook just ever so slightly in terms of how they did set up.
What did he make of Sergio Ramos' performance last night, Kenny?
Yeah, well, it's I had a sympathy
what
for
did you
him.
Think, what did you think of the red card? Come on, give me your thoughts as a king of a centre half. Give me your thoughts on his red card. Should VAR have looked at it?
I don't know. In terms of how VAR interprets in the Champions League, Kieran, it's slightly different, isn't it? How they look at the VAR and how they encourage the referees to operate. Look, if he had a look, that I don't think he would have changed it. Kieran, you kind of know different competition, referees referee the game a little bit differently. European games, international football, as opposed to your bread and butter week and week. I think if you're lucky enough to play those games, you realise how the referees referee differently. And the fact that he put his hands on his shoulder last night, I'd agree with you there. If you're suggesting there wasn't a huge amount of contact, it was a sufficient. He didn't get a hold of his jersey and pull him around.
Yep.
I think there was a minimum amount of contact, even with his foot, lads. I don't know if you saw that. There was a very small bit of contact actually with his feet as he went through. But Jesus, again, he's smart, lads. I'm saying again about his qualities. He's smart, and he knew as soon as he took that touch in front of Ramos, he was just waiting for any kind of contact, and Ramos had sympathy for him. He got himself goal side. It wasn't his own fault. Casemiro sold him down the river with the back pass to Varane, so he had to get back. And I've been in that position myself. You're wrong side of the defender, maybe through no fault of your own. You know he's coming in a goal 1v1 with the goal. You feel as if you have to do something, Kieran. You probably know yourself as a sportsman. You feel as if you have to disrupt them in some respect. You can't clip his heels. That's an obvious free kick and a red card. But you've got to make some kind of physical contact, even just putting your hands on him, something. Get hold of his arm, just tug him a little bit, put him off balance. I think that's what he tried to do. He took a calculated risk. I think some referees might have let him get away with it, but the fact he actually made contact with his shoulder and put his kind of hands on him, I think really sealed his fate.
City now fairly heavy favourites to go through, Kenny. Any concern,
heavy,
though? No, okay, we'll take the word heavy.
I thought you meant to win it. Sorry, Owen. Sorry, Jose.
To go through, yeah. To go through is what I mean. However, the Emerick Laporte injury, does that give you any concern at all about Manchester City in the second leg?
Yeah, would a little bit, because to the extent that it means Otamendi's got to play. So that, like I said, that always makes me nervous. You would imagine him and Fernandinho. I don't think Stones necessarily be available for that one. He might surprise again, maybe back three. I'm not too sure, but yeah, does make me nervous. But overall, I mean, I've seen Real Madrid play a few times this season. Just not sure they have it in them. I can see a better performance from Real Madrid. I can see them actually going there and scoring no problems on. But I just think Manchester City, again, if they get it right for the fourth leg, and like I said, I think there's more to come. I think they could swamp them a little bit in the second leg from an attacking point of view in terms of players on the pitch. Sterling, 100% match fit by that stage. He's got good options up the pitch at the moment. Mahrez in good form, his decision making with Aguero and Jesus, like we've spoken about. De Bruyne will probably drop back into a fair position, maybe a little bit deeper. So I just think they've got too much firepower for them, too much dynamism in the team, Manchester City. And if the Man City crowd get involved as well and energise the stadium, just feel as if they have far too much for them. So no, I wouldn't be hopeful at all for Real Madrid's chances.
Great stuff, Kenny. Chat to you soon.
Thanks, Kenny.
Nice one, lads. Take care.
Kenny Cunningham there on the line. It has just gone 8 o'clock, 3 minutes past 8 actually, on this Thursday morning. Plenty of stuff still to come for you on OTBAM. Brian O'Driscoll in studio from 8:15 this morning. And we are back with our top five stories next. OTBAM. You're welcome back. Top five stories this morning. Jarlath Burns, which we'll get into in just a moment. Some interesting lines from Brian O'Driscoll. You want to hang around for 8:15. We'll be coming back to a few of those themes later on in the show as well. Star players, whichever way you want to look at that, see what we've done there. Kieran Donaghy will be going through a couple of players to watch out for and players who are going to have a big year to come. We'll get into that very shortly indeed. After that, NBA bandwagons. The All-Star weekend is over. Now is the time to get on the bandwagon for basketball. So we'll pick one team from the West, one team from the East for you to watch, to have some sort of interest all the way through to June, hopefully anyway. And then Donaghy's Docs, he is the star of Lake Regale, so we'll get his view on his favourite sports documentary ever. We'll start with Jarlath Burns, I think. He was speaking on the show last night, talking about his candidacy for GAA president at Congress this weekend. A couple of things that emerged from this, he kind of had three different points to his manifesto almost. He said the first thing he wants to achieve is a new charter in training. He said the GPA needs to say to county boards that players will be unavailable for training until January the 1st, which I think, first of all, makes perfect sense, doesn't it? As an inter-county footballer, the worst thing is the heavy sessions you're doing in November, December, when the peak of your season actually doesn't come for 5-6 months after that.
7 or 8 months after
for
a lot of teams, you know. So it's, yeah, look, that's, look, I had Jarlath as a selector on the underdogs when we had that team in 2004, and you know, when he spoke in the dressing room, when he spoke in the training pitch, everybody listened. He seems like a massive leader. He was a massive leader in that dressing room that time. Mickey Ned was the manager, and Mihal Amar Hurtig was there. Mihal was brilliant with the players and individual and talking to guys and getting them going. But when Jarlath spoke out in the training field or on the pitch, you'd no choice but to listen. He was kind of a commanding figure. So, you know, I think if he did get in, he would be brilliant for the association. You know, I agree with a lot of his points in his manifesto. You know, we do have to look at our amateur players, because they are amateurs at the end of the day. And what's been asked of them at the moment is a full-time job, 31 or 32 hours a week. So it'll have to be policed by both the GEA, the GPA, and county boards. You know, county boards are constantly talking about the expenses of running inter-county teams. If you're going to be organising 4 team sessions a week and weight sessions, everybody in together and feeding players after all these sessions, your finances are going to go up and go through the roof and become unattainable. And then it becomes, you're just, it's the top teams that can afford to do that all the way. It's the crowds with the big sponsors. It's the crowds that, you know, and your other counties may not be able to compete with that. They mightn't be able to train 4 times a week together. So they're at a disadvantage straight away, which shouldn't be the case really when they actually need the opposite. It needs to be them that's training 4 times a week and getting all the nutrition and the weights and maybe the top teams not, but it's obviously not going to be that way. But just looking at it, it would be great that, and it'd be great for these lads to be able to train with their colleges and not have to do all that travelling. It's, training is one thing, but what people don't realise is when Kerry are training, fellas are coming from Cork, coming from Limerick, coming from Dublin, coming from all parts of Kerry, you know, constantly to train. So yeah, that 2 nights a week and not being allowed in there till January 1st and having a proper maybe month of pre-season would be great. Maybe you look at putting your Sigerson back, maybe, you know, back into the middle of November to the middle of December before their exams start. But there is certainly a lot of scope for that.
Let's hear what Jarlath Burns had to say. He was speaking on Off the Ball last night.
I think Paul Flynn and Seamus Heckey need to stand in front of the charge who have been complaining about this and say, right lads, from next year our players will be unavailable until the 1st of January. That's when they're going to do their first training session. As it stands, the most intensive training the players are doing are in November and December. Now you just think about that. November and December, and the first round of the championship is in May. Yeah. Right. That's point one. Point two of this new charter will be that up until the end of the league, county players will train Wednesdays and Fridays, no other night. You're immediately thinking, but they'll break that. Not if there's proper leadership. Not if we are going back to county chairs and saying, hang on, Buster, you told us you wanted to change. You told us that you wanted not to be spending as much money on this. We are providing a mechanism by which we can do this, and you are breaking this. Therefore, you've broken the amateur status. 10% of the 250,000 that Croke Park gives you is your fine.
That's a radical proposal.
I'm not finished.
Yeah, sure, but even on that point, so you think the GPA actually...
Yeah.
Are one of the key vehicles to actually enforce this?
And absolutely, it's the GPA they are the players' union. They are in charge of player welfare.
Mm. Is this possible that the GPA will be able to properly enforce this? I guess a better question to that is, will there be a way around this for counties who want to try and pull the wool over the GPA's eyes?
I think teams kind of just train 2 times a week anyway, so there's nothing too radical in that. I like the fact that when teams play in the weekend that they'll get till Wednesday off, and that'll be their proper session, and Friday will be getting ready again for the weekend. Fellas will still be in the gym on a Monday, you know, they'll still get their gym sessions in individually, but again, they can do that in their local area, they can do that in their local gym, and you don't have to be doing all the travelling, which I think is when we talk about players' welfare, that's what gets on top of guys, is getting into the car constantly and trying to travel long distances to make a weight session, you know. So I think, I don't think that's What about you? Do you think that's feasible that they train Wednesday and Friday?
Well, for me, it just seems like two sessions a week, whereas obviously what you're saying here is it's actually not. It's actually two collective sessions on the pitch training.
Yeah.
Because Mike...
They can't say that you can't do weights. You know, you can't say... Not in this day and age where players spend a huge amount of time rehabbing and prehabbing to not get injured. So, like, their weights has changed so much from the big bulky weights that we were doing when I started to, you know, the stuff that they're doing now, which is very tailored to injury prevention and, you know, making sure your hamstrings are strong and making sure your glutes are strong and your core is good, because you're not going to pick up that groin injury then, or you're not going to tweak that hamstring then. So fellas will still be doing that, you know, fellas will still get that in. But the fact that the one big session where you can actually train is a Wednesday night, you know, I don't see any GA player that has a problem with that.
No.
Not during the league. And maybe you tweak that and say, like, when you've a week's gap between games, you know, that might be the right training method. And then when you have a weekend off, maybe you do a Tuesday, Thursday, Sunday, or Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. Because you have to get that third session in if you've no game the following weekend.
You see, this is what I would say he's trying to actually rally against, that third session. That
I don't know if he's trying to rally against that. I think what he's trying to rally against is maybe being brought together three or four times a week for collective sessions. Whether that
just
be
the travelling.
I would say so. I think if you during the league, if you're off the weekend...
It'll cost you money to put on that training session, like nutrition and all that. And he wants to talk about cost saving measures.
Yeah, I know, but it costs you money to go and play your game too the weekend. You know, you kind of have to, as a GAA player, you want to do something the weekend. You know, fellas don't want to be sitting around all weekend doing nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, even if you train Wednesday and you train Friday, Sunday morning you probably want a trial game where you get to go out, and if you're a number 24 on the panel and you're trying to say, well, you know, I could only show so much on Wednesday and Friday. Maybe that Friday session is on that week is a kind of a multi session. Maybe you do a bit in the gym together and go out and play a bit of ball, and it's kind of seen as a bit of a lighter session. You go hard Wednesday, you've got that kind of collective, maybe a bit of gym stuff together beforehand, out onto the pitch for a bit of football, and then Sunday you're going back football again. Then you're off till Wednesday again.
Well, of course, there would be no issue here if there was a one-size-fits-all calendar for everybody and there was consistent fixtures throughout the season, when you knew that there was a game every weekend and your pre-season was a block, and then you get into the routine of playing every weekend.
Yep.
And then you get back into the routine of not having games at the weekend like every other sports person.
Yes.
in other codes around the country. So that would obviously be the ideal scenario, and I presume that Jarlett Burns would be on board for something like that as well. Like,
I would say so, yes.
He says that the GPA must stop being looked at as the bad boy and start being looked at as part of the solution, which is interesting. Like, I guess it's who is actually looking at the GPA as the bad boy? Like, is there actually a realistic view out there that the GAA sees them as the bad boy? I'm not sure that's the case at all. I think that's probably to do with maybe people on the outside looking in terms of their relationship with the GAA.
Yeah, no, like, I think it's a bit harsh to look at them as the bad boys, the GPA. Like, they're... I think, to be honest, Paul has done a great job since he's gone in. You know, he's been the most clear-cut guy that I've seen inside there, and, you know, he's come out with this, you know, with stuff that you kind of look at him and go, yeah, well, he's speaking from the heart here. He's speaking from what he feels he needs for the players, and he's just fresh out of it, so he knows exactly where every player is. I think he's done a great job so far. But yeah, I like to look at them as the, you know, I think the GAA might potentially look at them as a bit of an issue. But you can already see Jarlett isn't. He's getting in with them, and I'm sure that's very encouraging for the GPA that a future president, and likely president, is meeting them and kind of going, listen, you know, there's already a massive engagement there, and. You know, I'm sure Jarlett would look to do the same maybe with the CPA as well, and kind of, you know, get their thoughts. And the biggest issue in the GAA and the biggest issue that will hang over Jarlett's head straight away is fixtures. And, you know, he'll have to have that fixed by his term, because it's not fixed. And until we get, as you say, a proper calendar year in where everybody knows when they're on, you know, the GAA is going to continue to force people into decisions and force people to pick games and pick teams over and pick managers over other people, and to be just kind of pulled and dragged left, right and centre. And you know, I saw that firsthand, being involved with the Sigerson team this year in Tralee. There's a huge amount of pressure on these youngsters, and
that's another point that he's making, that players who play for the university will have to stay with them rather than travelling across the country to train with their county. And I know it's an issue that you would have had, every Sigerson manager and Fitzgibbon manager would have had it, where players are showing up for Kerry training and then can't really train for IT Tralee, which I guess is understandable in the current system, but it shouldn't be the way. Like, if this is what Gerald is saying, I think it's actually quite a good idea.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think if he's going to, you know, I think he's, if he can kind of figure out when that, again, this comes down to calendar, you know. If he's saying that none of the guys can train with their counties until the 1st of January, Sigerson starts on the 11th of January, you know, so these guys aren't allowed to train with their county up until the 1st of January, and then there's Sigerson games thrown in every weekend throughout January where a lot of, they're just starting to train, and we don't have David Clifford and we don't have Shawnee O'Shea and we don't have all these guys that are off in different colleges around the place. That becomes an issue, whereas I think you got to look at maybe getting the Sigerson in that window of mid-November to mid-December. I think the exams start like on the maybe the first week in November to the first week in December. I think they start on the 10th of December, them exams for the college kids. So maybe you try and get that Sigerson it done there, and then when teams go back and start on the 1st of January, that their sole focus then is that month's preparation ahead of the National League, which is loads of time to prepare and get right.
Yeah, absolutely. It is 8:17 on this Thursday morning. You're watching OTB AM. So yesterday, Brian O'Driscoll popped into studio for a chat with Ger and I. He broke down Ireland's defeat to England in Twickenham. You'll be able to hear the full 45-minute chat exclusively on OTB Sports Radio today from 2 o'clock. You can get that on the Go Loud app or on the TuneIn app. So it's OTB Sports Radio from 2 o'clock today. Offtheball.com/radio is where you can get that as well. Here is Brian on England's first try last weekend and what went wrong for Ireland straight from the off.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
It's on the touchline. Johnny May, I was looking at his foot. It looked as though
he might have touched.
Now, listen, we'll take the touch assistant referee's verdict over mine, but he was literally an inch from.
So not a bad box kick then.
So before we even get to that, like, I think the exit from that, it starts from a scrum. They have a ruck either side. For a right footer on the left-hand side to have to kick a box kick 20 metres infield over his left shoulder with pressure coming from Cruz, probably into a bit of a headwind, is a crazy exit. I tell you what we are missing. We're missing Rob Kearney's left foot on that side. It's what we used to have the whole time. I don't know why Jacob Stockdale's not stepping in there as a left footer on the left wing and relieving pressure, because that is a very, very hard kick for Conor Murray to enact. And I have to say, that first one, I thought it was an excellent kick, and he put it reasonable height, put it right on the money on where he would have wanted it. It stayed in field. Okay, if you get it out, great, but it stayed in field. Perfect opportunity, Jacob Stockdale to come in, and it's the easiest tackle. Your touchline best defender in the world is an inch away. You come from infield to off it, make your collision, see the ball in the air, that Johnny May's nowhere to go. But instead, he kind of sprinted the first few metres, kind of looked up, thought about a contest, and then kind of gave a half-hearted jump into Johnny May, which gave him an out, which he was able to peel infield.
He ushered him infield, basically.
Yeah, and the knock-on effect to that was that they put together another couple of phases, brilliant carry from Courtney Laws, great footwork at the line, and then this pre-planned move of, you know, going the same way. And maybe they'd done it a little bit in the first 7 minutes where they'd gone the same way, so to encourage Larmer to think that same way was going to continue. So he probably hedged his bets a little bit more on that open side. With the winger still playing very high, it's one of the repercussions that you might suffer on the basis of that defensive system of playing your wingers that high, is that the fullback has to cover so much backfield space. And Larmer probably, you know, in a perfect world, could have been another couple of yards closer to the back of where that ruck is. 15s need to be able to marshal, you know, both sides of the field, so a good line is right behind where the ruck is. But he favoured that side because he thought there might be a crossfield kick.
Yeah.
But great move back, and it was, I wouldn't quite say it was a perfect kick, because a metre before that would have been a perfect kick, guaranteeing that You know, Johnny Sexton would have had to carry it over the line. It was touch and go. Sexton didn't get a good first touch on it, and the rest is history. So, those things, of course, Johnny would be annoyed, and I'm not letting him off with it completely, but those things happen. A juggle like that with someone with good handling, particularly the way the ball bounces, you can't let the ball bounce around that much. You run the risk of exactly happening what did happen.
Yeah, so it's the compound of impact mistakes, but certainly Stockdale's defence there is questionable, and it seemed like his defence for most of the game was questionable. He's definitely on a hot seat, if not out of the team after that performance.
It's something that we know about his ability going forward, and there's no question marks around that. We need to get the ball in his hands as many times as we can, particularly one-on-one, because he looks as though he can still make something happen. But in defence, I think he doesn't have the same passion for defending as he does in attack, and I think that's evident. I saw it in the Scotland game when Hamish Watson made his break towards the end of the game. He's coming across from his blind wing, and it's a reasonable left foot step, but that, you have to remember, that's, you're 7 points down, that is body on the line stuff, and he fell off that tackle, and I think you can see it in an intent. I think he plays with this huge passion going forward. I just don't think he likes it as much in defence. And just, you know, some bad selections like that half-hearted, semi-jump. I'm not sure whether I'm going to get to it. It was a bit of a nothing thing with Johnny May that led to that first try. There was another one where Aki got cleared out off a kickoff. Johnny made a clean line to him where he only reacts just as the collision is being made, where he's a couple of metres away. He's got to run there and run a blocker line and run to the point of where the contact is going to be and protect his player. Just think he's not thinking his way through things, and whether the appetite isn't as great, you know, going backwards as it is going forwards. That's the way it appears. And I think, you know, your attack game has to be absolutely exceptional to be able to carry the negatives. And I don't think it is at the moment. I thought he was very good against Wales in attack, but very quiet against Scotland, incredibly quiet at the weekend.
You can sharpen those instincts, but can you teach them?
You can. I just, he's a young player too. And, I'm always very conscious of talking about, younger players when defence is the last thing that you learn. And I think some players get it quicker than others, and you are learning on the hoof. You know, maybe he found himself involved in the Irish team a little bit earlier than he might have envisaged. He got himself in some good positions. He also gets himself in good intercept positions at other times. I don't want to only pick out the negatives. I think there are some times that he gets into the passing channel and he shuts down options, and if the pass is given, he's there for an intercept, or he discourages the player inside to throw the pass. So that they're a good piece of defence, but I think there's enough of the other ones to send an early alarm bell that, you know, it's not the same on the front foot as it is on the back foot.
I think this is, again, comes down to the whole question at the start of the tournament, where if there's a debate about form, go with the player who hasn't got the experience just yet to try and boost the number of people who you can use. Under Joe Schmidt, the first team picked itself for such a long period of time, it's hard to imagine that Schmidt would keep Stockdale after that performance. But certainly it was harder to get out of the team sometimes once you made it in. What we need is now a bunch of players who are at the same level, and Keith Earls just automatically goes back in, and Jacob Stockdale's career is not ruined forever. It's like, you'll get back in when you learn these things.
You have to be mindful of the confidence that will affect with the younger player as well. And I don't think you can just continue to pick someone because you're worried about denting their confidence for the future, okay? So you have to hedge your bets a little bit on that and understand the individual. And I don't know Jacob Stockdale, what sort of character, whether he's mentally a very strong guy, whether I understood that his confidence took a big dent during the World Cup. Certainly defensively, he looked like it against New Zealand. So I am cautious that he's there for the long haul. So you have to try and manoeuvre and get the most out of him, where he is at the moment, and just try and help him problem solve on the hoof. That said, you look at someone like Keith Earls, and I'm such a Keith Earls fan that, you know, he's come on the last couple of games. He looks very exciting going forward. I know defensively, he's a lot smarter than, I think, Conway reads it very well too. But I think of the back three, that Keith Earls was probably our best defender, both from a reading a point of view, and that experience is telling, but also from a tackle point of view. If he gets the opportunity to really get after someone, I think he does it. And we've seen Stockdale occasionally do that, but not to the degree that Earls has done it consistently over the course of the last 10 years. And yes, he's come in and out of the Irish team, but for me, I'd be going back and starting him.
Would Stockdale be more or less exposed defensively as a 15?
Probably less exposed. I think you've less decisions to make. It's more one-on-one stuff. So it's less. Yeah, that's the issue with being a winger and playing hard up, is that at times you're going to have to read in. And at one stage, Robbie Henshaw, I don't know if you remember, Robbie Henshaw read through when George Ford ended up going for that really weird kick pass.
Yeah.
But if Ford actually just shifts it on really quickly to Elliot Daly, he's gone.
Yeah.
So, and the cardinal rule, even you can make your centre, a bad decision from your centre, look good by following suit. So if he goes, you go. And he played off. And I know that he probably was, as well, Robbie didn't need to shoot that time. And he did force an error, and he forced Ford's hand, so maybe he got away with it. But on another, if he's another fraction of a second, he might give that to Daly, and you've got to have Stockdale, following in there and closing that space as well. I think he would be less exposed at fullback because it is your last ditch there, aren't you? It's more about covering space rather than actually tackling. So it becomes very clear if you're being called into duty, it means that they've gotten a corner and your last ditch of defence.
Is there a similar conversation about Larmour acquiring the defensive skills as well? It's slightly less pronounced after the England game, but that ultimately he has that job of work to do too, to get to international level when it comes to the defensive side of his game. We know how electric he is as an attacker, and that he hasn't quite reached that point yet where he has the maturity to fully understand that there's a bit of a, they're showing me one thing here, but actually what's going to happen is something slightly different than
I haven't seen enough of him at 15. I would say yes is the answer. Probably it's a part of his game that he would be looking to evolve. He hasn't been called in a huge amount to make a lot of reads. Positionally, he looks okay, other than in defence. Other than that one where he got caught out with the young scrubber kick. So, and you have to remember too, there's two aspects to defending. There's the tackling, the physical part, and there's the reading of a defensive system, and they're two very different things. And you got to marry the two together. So I feel as though Stockdale is still unsure on the reading front, but as well he doesn't get after the hit as much as he potentially could when he absolutely needs to. Or where, we saw one in the Scotland game in the World Cup where he came in off the wing and he smashed someone. Like, what, if you can do that once, why can't you blindside people more or be able to? And part of it is about reading that situation to be able to see it in advance of it happening, to then get into the right spot to close that space down and make a big impact. But that Hamish Watson one for me, I think that's one where if you miss big because you're absolutely trying to annihilate a guy, and you're not thinking about technique there. You're thinking about, I just have to stop him at all costs.
Mm. You've come in after the first two games and said, actually, I looked back at those games and they looked a little bit better. Mm. When you look back at this one, did it look better or worse than
that? No, I don't think it looked better. The first half, I know that there were two kick scores, two handling errors, but it felt as though we didn't have any foothold into the game really at all. You look at those minutes 1, 2, and 3, two kicks in the first 2 minutes, and then the Manu, 10-meter gain when he's hit on the advantage line, and all of a sudden they're into flow. They all have cumulative effect on momentum, and it's besides the actual physical momentum, it's the psychological momentum of getting yourselves into a game. And there were very few high points from an Irish perspective in the first half. Like, they didn't, even on penalty advantage, the crossfield kick from Johnny before he missed his penalty and off the tee, the crossfield kick was poor. It didn't go anywhere near where it needed to go. So it was very hard to be positive about anything in the first half.
We seem to have a tendency to try...
Other than James Ryan's aggression, which was right on the edge.
Yeah, yeah. And could have been pinged straight off the first minute.
But you know what? I don't mind a player, you know, trying to set out a mark like that. We talk about, you know, Itoje did it for the second try.
And it works really well.
Holding, you know, James Ryan and Standard down in the ruck. And sorry, to talk about that as well, the knock-on effect that that has is Jonathan Joseph made a break because Ireland were two less defenders there.
Yeah. And he totally gets away with it.
And he was doing a job, so Cian Healy was the ball carrier, Furlong was the first clear out, Ryan and Stander were then both in it. It was only him. And then Conor Murray had that, you know, poor quality box kick. And then he held on to two of them. So that's, like, that sort of stuff is, yeah, of course, you run the risk of being penalised, but, you know, that was the difference to having a disjointed kick chase.
Yeah.
And where Jonathan Joseph was able to pick off. Dev Toner was late out of that ruck as well. He was then in the backfield that Joseph beat as like almost a 15. And then that built to a corner penalty, got a second penalty, and then they got the freebie on the penalty advantage. So it all tots up. It all adds. You can't go, you know, pick in isolation, oh, you know, bad handling errors. It just felt as though it was coming. And there was other... You know, there was other times just before half time they should have scored another try. They were hammering away, and they just didn't quite get it done. But it felt at half time, you know, 17-0. There was no coming back.
It was game over.
Yeah.
This goes back to the conversation that you started before the tournament about us not having enough dog in us. We don't have enough dog in us at the moment to beat England.
I have to say, and maybe, you know, I've seen it in aspects. I saw it in Furlong, you know, in the Wales game. I thought he played really angry. I saw it in Ryan, you know, for the first time. I thought he was just a brilliant player, but see that really nasty edge, I think, is it, for me, is a great sight, even
yeah.
And particularly in defeat.
We needed to see it from Furlong again. Like, so Furlong, if Ryan is going up against Lions. Rivals. Tyke Furlong has gone up against Lions rivals, and he's the man in possession. You know, we all thought like this is how you can chuck him in there for the next couple of Lions, but that's not the case at the moment.
I think as well, even Stander, you know, he's had two man of the match performances and a pretty good performance against England. So, you know, there's definitely shades of it. But it's, you just have to, you know,
it's a collective.
It is a collective, but also sometimes you've and when I talked about the lack of dog, I think it's a comparable to Irish teams of the last 5 or 6 years and the loss of a Sean O'Brien. And I can't tell you how much of a catalyst someone like, an individual like that is for everybody else to bring that aspect out in their game. And I just feel as though we're lacking one of those individuals. And maybe Ryan's that guy. Maybe he's going to step up to the plate in that front. But I hope it's not just an England performance that he... It's great to see a nasty edge. I love a second row, you know, throwing his weight around. And Nathan Hines being a pain in the arse. Paulie, likewise. You know, Fabian Palouse. These guys... They were a pain in the backside to play against. Maro Itoje.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine?
You need that in your team. And if you're just going to be to get the job done, I think it doesn't send out a message of be afraid of us.
Itoje ripping the ball off Kilcoyne as well. So Kilcoyne, everybody wants to see him in the team, get his opportunity, and he's carrying with aggression. But it's just like, I'm taking that. Thanks very much. This is big time now. Like that was, I thought that was one of the best second row performances I've ever seen. I can't believe he didn't get man of the match. Like, it was definitely, that is sensational stuff. Yeah. And because of the shithousery layered on top of that, it was like, okay, that's the standard now that we all need to get to.
Is it not almost more noticeable that this is just actually what we expect from Irish second rows and back rows, actually, that there is a good execution in certain areas of their game, but James Ryan is really the outlier. It actually almost is surprising to see someone in that green jersey show that little bit of dog. We almost associate it with the English. It's like all those bad guys coming up against the Irish and bending the rules and all that. That it's actually not something we expect from Irish players, and perhaps that kind of feeds down into every level of coaching and how teams are brought through in terms of their whatever their philosophy is.
I don't know about the second row thing. I think about the times that the players that I played with, Paddy Johns, you know, definitely not as skillful as a James Ryan or an Ian Henderson or a Paul O'Connell, but he was a thug. And he loved trying to maim people, and I remember playing against him in 99 after playing the World Cup, and I saw him in a ruck, and his kind of head was popped up, and he was primed to get absolutely smashed, and I came running like from about 15 yards away and hit him square in the chest. And as I lay down on top of him, he was like, "Dricka, that was some shot." I was like, "Oh my God, I've literally given him everything that I have, and he's commending me." And so there's guys like that, and you know, Jeremy Davidson was a tough nut. You know, just as I was coming in, he was coming to the end of his international days. Paulie, Mal wasn't really that sort of guy, but he was a very talented. He was almost a bit more of an Ian Henderson type player, very talented, you know, quite skillful, very athletic. So
if only Ian Henderson had the aggression that his frame suggests he could deliver. He'd be unstoppable.
Yeah. Lots of players get angry sometimes, but it's playing angry the whole time is part of being a really good international player and a world-class international player. And where, you know, there is, to coin Paul O'Connell's phrase, you know, put the fear of God in them, there is an aspect of respect before you take the pitch going, this guy takes no backward step.
Yeah.
And that's why the New Zealanders rated Shaunie so much, because they knew they were getting it. And I keep going back to him, but he's now the bar of where you want your players to be. And it was because he'd take you out in training as much as he would to the opposition in a test match. So it's in you. And yes, you can bring it out to a certain degree, but it's consecutively doing it, game after game.
Have we suppressed it under Joe Schmidt, though? Like, and is there going to be a transition period where this is free? So, famously, Schmidt's penalty count was low. Mm. And we were winning games on the basis that we never gave away penalties. Never gave away penalties because we weren't launching ourselves into rucks, clearing people out from the side. We were obeying the rules and doing exactly what we were supposed to do. And it really, really worked to the point where that team delivered a lot of success.
That could be a really good point, because, you know, maybe the lads were worried about overstepping the mark with the knowledge that on a Monday session they were going to be picked up on, you know, you two penalties today, we only had six in total, so you're on a third of our penalties, what's that about? So maybe they did suppress it a bit, but I think it's something that you have to allow evolve. And with those sort of players, you're going to give away the occasional penalty, but you know what you get on the flip to that is hugely positive in general, because it can be an inspiration. And I like playing with guys that wanted, that were up for the fight, irrespective of whether it was a hard track or a you know, pissy day. That lads, you knew you were going to get the same version of them, that they were uncompromising and were unwilling to ever take that backward step. And I think that's, you know, the skill aspect is one thing, but you know that really nasty hard edge is an important part of being a successful international over long periods and having a reputation for that.
If you look at any of the, particularly the famous YouTube video of Andy Farrell playing for Wigan in that match where they poked the head off each other, he had that. Mm. He took the field and everybody was like, if I'm going to punch Andy Farrell or if I'm going to get involved with him, I know I'm going to have to take multiple shots back.
The game has changed a bit.
I know.
Like 24 cameras, you know, you're getting away with nothing, but you can still...
Would just be Mauro Tolje.
Yeah.
Like, that level of aggression, or be James Ryan at the weekend. And so he obviously has an aggression in his defensive style and system, and also in his makeup as a player, you would hope that's going to come through as a coach. So are we just... Is that one of the things we can hope that's going to change over the next while? That he'll look at that at the weekend and go, well, that's unacceptable, and we're going to have to beat England. Every year we play England, we're going to have to come up with a game plan that is ready for them the next time. At Lansdowne Road, it'll be different. But the next time we go to Twickenham in 2 years' time, we're going to have to be ready for them. So what's he thinking?
I'm just trying to think, what was it? Did we have that when we won the Grand Slam only 2 years ago? That's not that long ago. A lot of the same players. I think there's been some new players that have come onto the scene in that time. You know, I look back to the back row that England were playing that day. Like, I know Sam Simmons was there and he'd an off game. So I think you're dealing with different sort of individuals in Underhill and Curry.
Yeah.
And so we've seen the birth of those as international players, and that they're here for a long time.
They're prodigies.
And then you put Courtney Laws playing really well and aggressively into that mix as well. Like, that's, you know, those three alone. And Underhill doesn't look as though he's a thug. He just is hard.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm ready for the fight. Likewise, Curry, I think he's got another, just from the outside, has a little bit more of an edge than Underhill, but he just wants to scrap for everything. And definitely, you know, with Laws. And they're just three. You know, I think Cruz has that edge. He wants to, if he gets a chance to hurt you, he will.
Yeah.
Told you, no doubt. George just does his job, but Sinclair has that in him. Marler definitely has it in him. So
that's Genge.
I've seen it. You look at, if you go through our pack, you know, Keane Healy can do that. Not sure about, you know, whether it's in Rob Herring's game. Furlong can. Peter O'Mahony can. Stannard can. Ryan can. So there's five of eight, but it's just seeing it the whole time. And I think players, it's funny, I'm sure it probably didn't go down particularly well within the camp that I talked about there being a lack of dog. But when you talk comparatively to those that have been there before, and Sean in particular, I think people will go, yeah, there's not that many Seans.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that's if you're comparing everybody else to him, I think you'll go, they'd have to go, fair enough, we don't really have any Seans here.
Yeah, like Ronan Kelleher is someone who's impressionable. Deegan and Doris, impressionable. Dan Levy will come back into the squad. He's got the potential for a bit of dog, that perhaps actually taking this idea to the next step and looking at what England did at the weekend, is it something that you can sort of mould at that age of a player where Doris and Deegan, I don't know, do you instruct them? How do you actually inform them to get to that pitch?
I remember hearing about, I feel like I'm Shawnee's agent here trying to promote him, you know, but I remember hearing about him playing for UCD before he ever came into the Leinster setup. God, this guy's got a proper edge to him.
Right.
And sometimes that can be good, and sometimes that can mean he's a serious hothead. But then when you marry real ability on top of an attitude like that, and he wasn't the biggest guy in the world, so you're like, all of a sudden when he came in, it was like, oh, this is so exciting. And I think there's an aspect to that, to Doris. I don't know him personality wise at all, but he looks abrasive,
yeah,
and he looks like he's
carries
got good skills, and he carries, and he's there, and you know, if there's a shot to be had, he'll try and, you know, have a go at someone's ribs. That's the sort of thing that you want. It's about trying to get after someone. And people are like, oh, you can't be encouraging people to go out and hurt people. It's the physical game. That's what we try and do. We try and,
but where's the,
you know, psychologically get the better of the opposition by the power that we exert on them. And that comes from putting in as many big shots as you possibly can.
Yeah. OTB
AM. Brian O'Driscoll there. Full chat coming up on OTB Sports Radio from 2 o'clock today. It's 45 minutes long and it is worth your time. Make sure to download the Go Loud app. It's available on TuneIn as well, or offtheball.com/radio as well. Stephen Doyle, you're very welcome.
Morning all, thank you.
I should introduce Stephen. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Stephen's work, Kieran, but Stephen Doyle, over the course of the Dublin five in a row, has become
the
chief yearer in the history of man. He has actually gone above and beyond anything that any Kerry man has ever done in terms of downplaying Dublin expectations. You will probably come in here now and say that Dublin probably have half a chance of winning the All-Ireland this year or something like that.
Well, look, you can only go on form, can't you, Owen? And I would have to say Dublin's form has been patchy at best. So,
yeah, you know, the miracle comebacks are just happening by pure fluke.
But I think we can yerrah together here, Kieran.
Yeah,
because Galway are absolute dead certs.
Absolutely, dead certs.
They are the favourites.
Galway to run All Ireland final.
You're only as good as your last game, Owen.
Exactly, completely agree. Where are we starting today, Stephen?
The British government in talks with the RFU over England's Six Nations game against Italy. That match is due to take place on March 14th. It follows yesterday's news that Ireland's match against Italy on March 7th has been postponed due to the threat of the coronavirus. The corresponding women's and under-20s matches are also off. The Italian Federation has said its government will decide whether the England match on the final weekend of the tournament goes ahead. Six Nations organisers said last night all of the other matches are scheduled to go ahead, but will continue to monitor the situation, quote, very closely. Around 20,000 England supporters are expected to attend the match in Rome. The women's and under-20s teams are also due to play in Italy on the same weekend, but they are in the northern part of the country where 11 towns have been placed on lockdown. The upshot of all this, of course, is that head coach Andy Farrell could be facing the prospect of not having an Ireland game until that tough trip to Paris on March 14th. And former Ireland out-half Ronan O'Gara was talking on Off the Ball last night about how problematic that situation could be.
when you're a player, especially after how Sunday went, you just want to get on that pitch as quickly as possible. Not for a training session. A training session helps, but what really helps is having a game to get that out of your system. But if it's the schedule, as you have said there, that they go to Paris next, that's a difficult task. I think it was ideal getting a little bit of confidence back under the belt.
So it's probably an aspect of, I think, all of yesterday's chat that maybe was a little bit overlooked. Look, I suppose, you know, this the illness that's spreading around Europe is obviously the main concern, but it's going to be a concern for Andy Farrell if the game in Paris goes ahead and he's had no match between now and then. Ireland going straight into the white-hot atmosphere of the Stade de France. Moving on then to Manchester City boss Pep Guardiola saying that his players are not motivated by the club's impending European ban. City on the verge of dumping the 13-time European champions Real Madrid out of the Champions League. Madrid had led the first leg of the last 16 tie by a goal to nil at the Bernabeu last night thanks to an Isco strike on the hour mark. But goals from Gabriel Jesus and Kevin De Bruyne gave City a 2-1 win in the Spanish capital. Sergio Ramos sent off to rub salt into the Madridista wound. City facing that two-year European ban, though, for breaching financial fair play rules. But Guardiola insists the players aren't thinking about that.
What we can do to help the team is play good and winning games. That is only we can do. And hopefully the board, the lawyers and the rest can convince the UEFA that we did the good things, the nice things and not wrong things.
Now, it was a bad night for Juventus as well, who went down 1-0 away to Lyon in their Champions League tie, but I suppose they will be favourites going back to Italy for that second leg. Rangers are into the last 16 of the Europa League after they beat Braga 1-0 in the second leg of their tie in Portugal last night. That game finished 4-2 on aggregate. Tonight, Manchester United, Wolves, Arsenal and Celtic all in second leg action. Wolves up first at 5:55 in Spain with a 4-0 lead from the first leg against La Liga relegation battlers Espanyol. Manchester United are 1-1 against Bruges going to the second leg at Old Trafford. Celtic and Copenhagen all square 1-1 as well before their meeting at Parkhead tonight. And Arsenal are 1-0 up as they host Greek side Olympiacos. Those three games kick off at 8 p.m. And there's a 7-race card at Clonmel this afternoon. First race going to post at 2 o'clock.
Stephen Doyle, thank you for that. Great stuff. Turning our attention back to the Champions League next year on OTB AM. Dermot Corrigan will be joining us live from Madrid. Before that, here is Ronan O'Gara talking about Johnny Sexton.
I think he was struggling obviously with the frustration of probably some of the interpretations around the ruck from Yako, but also I think struggling with the malaise of his team. You know, as a halfback or as a 10 especially, you crave space and time on the ball. He had zero on both fronts. But the opportunities, I suppose, in his own game where he'll measure himself on, he'll be disappointed in terms of catch pass or quality of kick from the ground or from the hand or from the restart. So I think, you know, for something like that, I think you separate the goal kicking completely. There's a lot in his plate with the captaincy. I wasn't a fan of it day one, as I said here, in terms of, I think what he has brought to the jersey and to a position, absolutely huge honour and fully entitled to have that on his CV. But for me, a captain or a team is better suited with another leader as your captain as opposed to the number 10, because he's the on-field leader anyway. Everything strategically goes through him. Everything in terms of the tempo and the vibe on the pitch is through him. You just, sometimes for his own good, you need to take that away from him, I would feel.
Yeah, Rugby and Off the Ball is where you'll get that full podcast, or you can watch the full thing back on youtube.com/off the ball. Dermot Corrigan, a very good morning to you. How are things?
Pretty good, Owen. How's it there?
All good, all good. So I presume it's been a suitably calm and composed reaction from the Madrid media to last night's result.
Yeah, more a shock than anything else, really. Because at one point in the game, it wasn't a great game, I guess. The first half wasn't so exciting last night, pretty tense. But then when Madrid went ahead, the mood in the stadium was great. You know, the fans were singing, "We're the Kings of Europe." Madrid started to play some nice stuff. And then the last 15 minutes, it just all fell apart. City scored twice, could have scored more. Ramos was sent off. And everybody, the Madrid journalists here, the fans in the stadium, the journalists as well in the press room and people talking to this morning, everybody's just really disappointed. Maybe not completely surprised because, you know, this Madrid team is not as good as a couple of years ago, but just very, very down at how it ended.
In terms of the surprise, I guess, there has been a tone around Madrid at the moment that perhaps they aren't what they were once at, and I think that's a fact, actually. It's not just an opinion. But at the same time, I'm sure there's an opinion out there today that you have to use the tools at your disposal. Toni Kroos is one of those tools.
Yeah, it was a very strange one. We kind of expected Guardiola to come up with a surprise in his starting 11. He likes to throw maybe an unusual lineup in for these big games, or to have a special plan for it. Didn't expect Zidane to also do that. And Kroos has been, you know, really important for them. He's the guy who sets the tempo for the team. He's the guy who always has most passes in the game, who kind of organizes their play. So to see him out of the game completely was a big surprise. Zidane afterwards said it was just a technical decision. He didn't want to get into it, but there's no injury involved. And that of the decisions from Zidane, that's the big one that stands out this morning.
Is there any theories out there as to what the technical decision was?
Well, my theory, I guess, is that Zidane, he wanted to more physical guys in midfield. He had Casemiro there to hold in front of the defence, and then he wanted the rest of them to get forward, to put pressure on City, to try and play the game in City's half, to disrupt City. And Valverde is very good at that, who came into the team in the centre. He's, you know, much more athletic. He's got more energy maybe than Kroos. He gets around the pitch a lot more, and he can get in the way of City's ball players. Isco as well, you know, he scored the goal in the end, and Zidane wanted Isco and Modric to be up around the City box to try and create something there, and he didn't want Kroos to play the game at Kroos's pace. That's one theory. It didn't work out so well for Madrid in the end, but maybe that's what Zidane was thinking.
Yeah, perhaps Zidane was focusing on the wrong area of the pitch, because you look at Pep Guardiola's comments in the aftermath, and he says that we played a proper striker because of the way they defend. They are so aggressive through the middle, and when that happens, you have to make the pitch wide. Ramos, Varane, Casemiro, they win these balls. Incredible. It was almost as if he gave up that area of the pitch, in certain areas of central midfield anyway, and just attacked down the wings. Obviously, we saw that with Gabriel Jesus playing as a left wing back. Did Zidane get outthought in that respect? Did he not expect to see what's coming from Manchester City in the wide channel? And did he react properly to that tactic from Guardiola?
Yeah, it was very interesting to hear Guardiola talk quite at length about how he'd watched, you know, 10 games of Madrid during when he was supposed to be on his mid-season break, that he spent it analysing Madrid and coming up with a plan. Because, you know, when his starting 11 were on the pitch or for up until the 75th minute, you know, it wasn't working out. They were 1-0 down. It was when Sterling came on. It was when De Bruyne came deeper, and Gabriel Jesus scored the goal from a centre forward position, not from out on the wing. So maybe Guardiola was very happy to have beaten Madrid. Obviously, as an ex-Barcelona player and coach, to win at the Bernabeu was huge for him, and he talked a lot about his plans and everything. But I don't know really whether it was Guardiola's plan or whether it was just City's just much better players and much better energy at the end of the game that won it for them.
Yeah, I'd kind of definitely lean towards the latter of your two arguments there for sure, because like he comes with this pragmatic approach, this 4-4-2, and really what actually wins them the game is when they shift approach, when they're 1-0 down. And of course, you know, I saw what was the Opta stat last night that Real Madrid haven't had, it was their fewest shots in the first half of a home Champions League match since November 2013 against Galatasaray. So 3 shots in the first half. So in fairness, Guardiola's pragmatic approach worked in that regard, but actually going out and winning the game came from a bit of a tactical shift, and as you say, Jesus through the middle.
Yeah, the impression that got maybe from the game was that Madrid, Guardiola set up to defend against Madrid, he would have been happy enough maybe with a nil all, or maybe he thought he would be able to nick it late on. But Madrid were just maybe there for the taking a little bit. And when they did start to push, it was like pushing against an open door. Madrid started to make mistakes. You know, Carvajal, awful challenge for the penalty. Ramos was at fault for the first goal. Then he gave away he got sent off as well. That Madrid are, you know, Guardiola had said, you know, how strong Madrid's defence are and everything. But actually, when they did attack them, Madrid kind of fell apart a little bit at the end.
Is Sergio Ramos still revered? Is this Real Madrid defence getting the full backing of confidence from supporters at the moment?
Yeah, Sergio Ramos is such a huge character, and he's such a huge part of Madrid's club's history, Spain's history with winning the World Cup and the Euros, and he's club captain, and he's such an influential guy. You know, he's even part of, everybody knows him in Spain, even if you're not a football fan, he's part of Spain. So to criticise him is very difficult here, and a lot of the local journalists shy away from it. They prefer maybe to focus on somebody else making mistakes. But he's not had a good couple of years. You don't remember last year when he got himself booked deliberately to miss the second leg against Ajax, and then was watching in the stands as you know, being filmed for a documentary as his team went out. This season, he's made a lot of mistakes. Like at the Drew 2-2 against Celta Vigo at home a couple of weeks ago, he was at fault for the late goal in that game. Even last night, you know, early on in the game, he miscued a clearance to Jesus, who might have scored. He almost scored an own goal at just that corner before halftime. There's a scramble on the line. You know, one of his teammates had to help him out there. And then he was involved in the first goal and then sent off. So people are starting to point the finger a little bit. You just can't help but point the finger at him because he was just so bad, I guess. But still, he has that little bit of protection. Maybe like someone like John Terry in England, who, you know, as national captain and as such a big figure, you know, tended not to get criticised quite as much as maybe he deserved.
Yeah, and I guess there's probably a statistical shield for Sergio Ramos as well. If you look at the defence as a whole for Real Madrid this season, nobody has conceded less goals than them in La Liga so far. Is that sort of a false stat that can sum up where Real Madrid are at defensively?
Yeah, I think, like, they have played really in the... They've been very cagey in all of their big games. Like, the Clásico before Christmas at the Camp Nou was nil-all. Neither team looked great in that game, and both teams were really focused on not making mistakes and not letting the other team counterattack against them. And against Atletico Madrid, have kept a couple of clean sheets as well and beat them in the league. But I think... This has been coming, that Zidane was doing his best with the team that he had to try and make them as compact as possible, or to try and get the most out of the team, because he doesn't have the attacking stars that he had before. So they're conceding less goals, they're scoring a lot less goals as well. And Zidane did his best to get them this far. But as you said at the start, it's not the Madrid of a couple of years ago. Their best players are either a lot older or have left. So, yeah, the defensive stats do look good. But, you know, when it came down to it last night, they weren't able to deal with City's attack.
Marca is saying this morning that Eden Hazard is the only world-class, truly top player that this club has in its ranks now. And it cites transfer market as a couple of reasons why Manchester City are far ahead of Real Madrid at the moment, if you just look at transfer valuation and all that sort of thing. I presume this is something that Madrid are looking to address this summer. They probably have a hit list of targets, because this is what Real Madrid do, even though last summer, despite Hazard and the lack of luck he's had with his fitness, it was a fairly prolific summer last summer.
Yeah, they've had a couple of years of trying to bring in new players, trying to bring in younger players to refresh the team, and finding it difficult, partly because it's so hard to get rid of the guys that they have. Like Bale, they'd love to move him on, but nobody will take him because of his wages. It was very interesting to see that Raheem Sterling interview in the Spanish media here last week, where he posed with the Madrid jersey and then claimed that, you know, he was delighted to be at City for the moment if they are that Champions League ban does happen. And after last night, you know, he impressed everybody when he came on winning that penalty. He'd be a guy who you could see Madrid going for, and for sure whenever things go badly at Madrid, then the reflex action from the president Florentino Perez is to try and spend some money to get some more big name players in. And yeah, I'd expect that. Well, you know, they could always come back. We're talking a bit as if they've got been knocked out, and maybe they will come back in the second leg, because they do still have, you know, lots of experience and lots of talent in the team. Looks unlikely, but if they do go out, then yeah, they'll spend.
Just on Barcelona then, Dermot, is it possible for them to win this competition without Luis Suarez?
It's going to be difficult as well. Like, I would say any team that has Leo Messi in it has a chance to win any game. You know, he's head and shoulders above everybody in Spain for sure at the moment, and we'll see in Europe. But I wouldn't rule out any team with Messi in it. But apart from that, they're similar enough to Madrid in that their best players have got older. Suarez is injured. You know, that's a kind of wear and tear issue that he's been through so much. Same with Pique, Busquets, the guys who've held them together for so many years. So both Madrid and Barca, you'd have to say that they're great teams of a couple of years ago, when the Clásico was amazing and, you know, pretty much the World 11 you could pick between the two teams, it seemed like, or from our perspective here in Spain, that's what it seemed like anyway. That doesn't happen anymore. They have a couple of good players who are coming down from their peak, and the best players are maybe elsewhere now.
It might take a little while for a Clásico encounter like we have this weekend to sort of get the full global attention, potentially. Like, I see what you're saying, but at the same time, the fact that we were seeing Real Madrid and Barcelona in a slight bit of decline, there's almost more of an interest in that, because it increases the stakes this weekend. It's a must-win game at the Bernabeu on Sunday night for both teams.
Yeah, it's huge. For Zidane, especially because of how last night went, if they were to lose again against Barcelona at the weekend, then he would be in big, big trouble. They'd be 4 points off. They'd have lost. It'd be three defeats in a week for them, which would be pretty bad for them. Barca as well, you know, they sacked their coach already. So, you know, Kike Setién just came in. He's difficult for him. He's trying to implement a new style of play, trying to get the players to understand his pretty complicated concepts on how the game should be played. So neither team are coming into it in great form. Whoever wins will get a huge boost out of it. Winning the Clasico is going to, you know, propel them forward maybe over the rest of the season. But whoever loses, it's going to be a tricky, especially if it's Madrid and they're out of the Champions League and they're out of the La Liga race. It's going to be another very tricky couple of months as we go towards the end of the season.
You mentioned Kike Setién's fairly complicated theories on how to play the game. Perhaps if he uncomplicated it and just got Messi the ball more and made him the very centre point of everything that they do, things might take an upturn in results, especially without Suarez in the fold?
Yeah, it's basically... That's what happens at Barca. Even no matter what coach comes in and tries to work his concept, we've seen it with Setién, even from over the six weeks or so he's been in the team, that he's had to refine his ideas or be a little bit less ambitious with the changes that he makes. But Barca are turning into a little bit like Argentina when we saw them at the World Cups, where everybody wants to give Messi the ball. The opposition know it as well. So often there'll be like four or five players around Messi, and there is space elsewhere for people to exploit, and Messi's very good at drawing everybody towards him and then, you know, clipping a ball over the top to somebody else. But they don't have the talent around him that they did before. And, you know, we saw Napoli the other night. They managed to shut down Barca really well. You know, they had got players around Messi, made it very tight. Barca had no shots on target in the first half of the game, only a couple over the course of the game. They got out of it. Griezmann scored and they're, you know, looking like they'll go through. But again, it's Messi is great, but whether he's great enough to be able to pull the whole team through the way that he couldn't with Argentina, maybe he can't with Barca either.
Yeah, well, plenty of theories and plenty of storylines going into Sunday night. Listen, Dermot Corrigan, thanks a million for taking the call.
Cool, cheers on.
Cheers, Dermot. That's Dermot Corrigan on the line from Madrid. We are back with John Duggan's Virtual Insanity in just a moment, and we'll also be hearing about Kieran Donaghy's favourite sports documentaries. Back in a sec. OTB AM. It's gone 9 o'clock on Thursday morning, which can mean one thing and one thing only. Time for Virtual Insanity. John Duggan.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's €915 in the pot, which is a little bit down this year, but we want to know where we are in December. That's the key thing. Couldn't hit a barn door, but I've been a bit unlucky as well. So three things about betting you need to know. Obviously, you need to gamble responsibly. Actually, it's four things now. I've just said that. That's the first thing I say. It's about profit. It's not about winning and losing. It's about staking, and it's about a long-term game. I want to know where we are in December. I know we're going to get 50-1 winners, 100-1 winners. I can just feel it. Manchester City won last night. I knew that would happen. I know this is going to happen, right? So the Honda Classic is this week's tournament. Paddy Harrington won it a few years ago. Tees off around lunchtime in PGA National in Florida. That's, you're going to get your bets on by lunchtime if you're going to have an interest. Always go each way as well. Big field for the Honda Classic. Windy Florida course redesigned by Jack Nicklaus. The Bear Trap 15 through 17. Tough course. Fairways and greens. So who are the fairways and greens guys? Billy Horschel. Big ball striker Billy, streaky player, 5 PGA Tour wins, including the Tour Championship. Fairways and greens for Billy, tied for 9th in Phoenix, tied for 9th last week in Mexico. 2 top 10s in this tournament before in Honda Classic. 25-1 for Billy, 50 odds if you shop around the first 8 places. 3 each way, Billy Horschel. Next, Tommy Fleetwood. England's finest from Southport, never won on the PGA Tour. Hard to believe that. Tommy Fleetwood has never won there. European Tour legend, 4th on his only previous Honda Classic start. He's got the course for him. 12-1, 50 odds, the first 8 places, has been playing well. 3 each way, Tommy Fleetwood, the long-haired lover from Liverpool. Emiliano Grillo from Argentina, another fairways and greens machine. 3rd in Puerto Rico last week, noticed that. Tied for 8th of the Honda in 2018. And in 2017, he was doing well here before he was 77 in the final round. 80-1, a quarter of the odds, the first 5 places for Emiliano Grillo from Argentina. 2 each way on Emiliano Grillo. And to finish, Lee Kyung-hoon, or Kyung-hoon Lee, whatever way you want to call it, for the South Korean, coming off the back, interestingly enough, 2 top 15 finishes on tour, tied for 7th in his only start in the Honda Classic last year. 100-1, Spanish holiday, 5th of the odds, the first 8 places for Kyung-hoon Lee, or Lee Kyung-hoon. Well, it doesn't really matter if he wins. 2 each way on him. Put all these bets on offtheball.com/golf. John Duggan's Virtual Insanity, back next Thursday from 9, with vast riches in your pockets.
Kieran, you've been jotting it down? Everything down? You've been making a lot of money this year?
No, he hasn't.
No. But I trust in Jan's knowledge. And just Tommy Fleetwood. I have a feel for Tommy Fleetwood this week, so...
Fleetwood.
Yeah, you're getting a double whammy. You're getting John and myself going for Tommy there. So get on him; he's going to win.
It's like your Cheltenham theory when you say my tips and whoever else is it in the papers, then that's the golden thing.
Yeah, the golden ticket is just listen to what John Duggan says and then just cross reference it with anything. And if like Ruby is tipping him, then you go with that. So
yeah, you go with it.
I just need to find like if like Paul McGinley or someone needs to start doing golf tips so I can cross reference.
You see, I get these people on Twitter saying I'm copying everybody else, which is pretty nasty stuff.
Yeah, so don't listen to the trolls.
I try not to, and then I do my own, and then I realise, oh my God, Steve Palmer, who's the greatest golf tipper of all time, or Ben Coley, they've tipped the same guys. But nobody's tipped Emiliano Grillo. Nobody has tipped Kyung Hoon Lee this week.
They're the big ones.
So remind us again, who are you looking out for?
Billy Horschel, the ball striker. Yeah. Billy Horschel wears the colourful clothing, 25-1.
The Liverpool lover.
From the long-haired lover from Liverpool, Tommy Fleetwood.
Is that official nickname, yeah?
No, it's not.
We wanted to be no, John. I wanted to be no.
Emiliano Grillo and Kyung Hoon Lee. So, look, it's. I actually do think, I mean, I think it's best to have just an interest a year or two each way, but I do believe golf is where the money is. And I do believe I've had some crazy winners in the past, and I do believe that's the only sport. If you had a horse in a race, the Grand National, you can often sometimes have a. But if you look at a 50-1 bet in a soccer match, you're not going to get a 50-1 winner in a three horse race, but you can get anybody who's 50-1 in the golf tournament does have a chance. Yeah. Patrick Reed last week is 45-1, and he's always got a chance. You always have a chance in golf. The reason why the odds are so good is because the size of the fields.
What's your take on where Rory's at after the last 2 weeks?
I'm a little bit concerned because I think that you'd want to be winning these tournaments to take the pressure off his mentality for the Masters. Because if you're not winning and if you haven't won this year and you go into Augusta and you have all these questions and you have all these thoughts and you know you're trying to complete the slam and then you're on the back nine, I kind of get the sense that Rory, if he's going to win the Masters, would probably want to win it with a 64 and stay in the clubhouse and let everybody else falter. Because at the moment, I just felt that he had ample opportunity to win the Genesis and to win in Mexico last week, and he didn't take them. Like, he got out of the blocks really quickly last Thursday. It just didn't happen. So a little bit concerned, but he's talking a good game, and his consistency has been excellent. So I'd just love to see him win a bit more.
Good stuff, John. Thanks for popping in this morning. That is Virtual Insanity every Thursday morning on OTB AM from 9 a.m. Right, so the latest series of Laker Gale is upon us and it's kicking off with Kieran Donaghy next Thursday on TG Cahir. So the schedule goes like this. It's going to be Kieran up first on the 5th of March. Then a week later on the 12th of March, it's going to be Diarmaid Ling, Alan Brogan after that. Then Iggy Clark, Galway hurler on the 26th of March. David Brady on the 2nd of April. And then Brendan McInnesby on the 9th of April. So we'll come back to Kieran's episode in just a moment. But first, let's go back to Tuesday night's Off the Ball because David Brady himself was in studio with Joe chatting about his episode.
You don't start the 0-4 final and you address that, and your brother Jer in the piece says that you and Mahon had a love-hate relationship. Is that right? Is that how you describe it?
I wouldn't say love-hate. And I was, I was pretty adamant too that I talk about Hugh Lynn and I go up through my club manager, Martin Sheridan, under 14, under 16. We won two county titles, great times. Mm. I had Martin Kearney, brilliant. Absolutely phenomenal. Every game we ever played afterwards, Martin had always write to you. Always.
Sorry, write to you?
Yeah, a note. Not every game, but every important game, every final, definitely. You'd have the note from Martin Kearney and family. Gina Lauretta.
To say what?
Good luck.
Really?
The whole thing is, these people never forget. And it still means something to them. Yeah. And for me, it'll still mean something to me when I'm 60 or 70. And I'll maybe be in the position to write to someone that I managed. And you always say it's horses for courses, but you're kind of going, they're good people. Mm. And John Mahon was the first man that brought me onto the Mayo team. And I'll be forever indebted for him. Now, love, hate. Look, we talk about it in the film, I think. People make mistakes. Mm. I probably make mistakes, but John definitely made a mistake. Mm. And I go back and I say, as the one thing, you do not gamble with Mayo football.
And he took a risk in saying, well, you'd come off the bench again for Manna, I think it was, and you'd played extremely well in the quarter-final, so I'm not sure why you were left off against Fermanagh, what the issue was, but the risk as it was billed against Kerry was, will hold you back on the bench. That's the gamble when you say gamble.
That's the gamble.
Okay. Did he ever explain the gamble?
No.
Really?
No. And I didn't answer. I knew the gamble. He didn't have to answer to me.
Yeah.
But sure, the gamble didn't work. We've gambled since.
Yeah, it's a brilliant listen. Well worth checking out. It's on the GAA network of our podcasts and Off the Ball, wherever you get your podcasts, and as well on youtube.com/offtheball if you want to watch the full thing back. As I say, Kieran, your episode is up first this day next week on TG Cahir, and then there's five or six episodes thereafter. David Brady's the penultimate episode of the series. I watched yours last night. It's very good.
How'd you get that?
We have our ways. we might chat about it a little bit at the end if we have time, but what I actually want to do this morning is chat to you about your favourite sports documentaries. Having been in one now, having the expert view of being on both sides of the camera lens for sports documentaries, we might go through perhaps your top five favourite sports documentaries. Is that something you're up for?
Yeah, no bother.
Oh look, we have a pre-prepared list in front of us.
Oh yeah, we've done a bit of...
Oh, there it goes.
We've done a bit
the
of
list. I have a spare list here. Oh, yeah.
I have the list. sports documentaries. Being on, look, Laker Gael, it's an absolute honour to be on it. When I was asked, I was flattered and delighted to do it. And I believe it's a good enough show. We watched it in the Greyhound Bar last Sunday night, and there was a big crowd there. So we got you weren't the only one to get a little preview. I'm going to start at number five. The Bad Boys, ESPN, obviously, they're the king of documentaries and sports documentaries, especially the sport I love most, which is basketball. So, The Bad Boys, about the Pistons in the late 80s and 90s, they were the mean team. They had Bill Laimbeer, big 6'11" white guy, used to go around. If he was playing the NBA now, he'd be suspended. He wouldn't play six games a season because he'd be probably in jail for some of the stuff he did in the basketball court. So they had the famous Jordan rules when Jordan was trying to break through break into winning an NBA championship. These boys had a thing called the Jordan rules, and the Jordan rules were anybody that came near the basket was absolutely killed, especially Michael Jordan.
You so got Isaiah Thomas there in the picture there. What a player.
They had Isaiah Thomas and Joe Dumars. They had loads of skills, and they won two championships in an era where the Celtics and the Lakers were really dominant. So they were a brilliant team. They had Dumars and Isaiah Thomas in the backcourt. Fascinating relationship between the two of them.
And Rodman.
Look, Dennis Rodman was who I modelled a lot of my game on, and who I probably still play most like, because I could get 20 rebounds and no points. So I think Dennis Rodman is the player to have the most rebounds and no points. He's five games, one game he 28 rebounds and no points.
Is he an underrated facet of the Bulls?
Hugely.
Yeah.
And I think real basketball people and real people with knowledge of the game, Rodman's never underestimated. Rodman was the best defender. Rodman used to pick up all the best guys, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, and he'd take them out of the game. He was called the worm because he was able to get inside your head. He was physical, he was in your face. You're talking about shithousery that we talked about last week on Shot Clock. Dennis Rodman would be up there with the kings of shithousery. A very quiet guy in his Pistons day. He had the black hair. He was really inside himself. He got Defensive Player of the Year. He couldn't make his speech because he was crying so much during it. He actually couldn't get the words out about how proud it was that he was the best defender in the NBA. A very intriguing character. And yeah, they had Bill Laimbeer, as I said, who was a hatchet man but could step out and shoot the three and extend the floor. They had Mark Aguirre, who from the west side of Chicago that we'll talk about later on, as well as Isaiah Thomas, both from the west side of Chicago, both went to Detroit and actually had a lot of people in Chicago during them times cheering for the Pistons because of their allegiance to them. So a really good documentary. It goes through the rise and the fall, how they got to the top and what started to break it down, and characters within the team and the way they've done it and the settings they use is a really great documentary. So I'd urge you to check that out. Number four on my list is Unguarded.
I haven't seen this one.
Yeah, look, go home and watch it tonight and give me a text later on. About Chris Herron from Fall River, Massachusetts, a tough area in Boston. White guy, 6'4", could shoot, could really play, went to Fresno State University, had huge kind of drawbacks to troubles in Boston, you know, in the area he's from. Drugs was a huge part of it. He had huge addiction problems. He went to Fresno State and would get away from it, but then people would come out from Boston and would bring him drugs, and when he'd come back in the off season, he'd get back involved in it again, and he'd a constant battle. And there was huge hope and prayers that he'd get drafted into the NBA, and where would he get drafted? And, you know, his family and a lot of his close friends were saying, as far away from Boston as possible, this guy can get drafted, and he might be able to turn his life around, and because he'll get away from all the people he knows, the circles he knows, in relation to the drugs. Gets selected by the Boston Celtics, which, in a sick way, was so sad, because it should have been a dream for this kid from Boston to represent the Celtics. He loved the Celtics, coming off the back of Larry Bird and that team. He could have been the next white hope. He was brilliant. He was a really good player. But it was the worst thing that ever happened to him. He's standing outside in the parking lot 15 minutes before a game waiting to get these uppers and downers, these drugs he was on. He couldn't function without them. There, the national anthem's going on inside in the hall. Chris Herron, the rookie point guard, is out the back waiting to meet some guy and do a deal with him and get back in. He ends up over in Italy. He's got a family. Ends up going away, getting I think, heroin out there in Italy, and falling asleep at the wheel and crashing his car. And his wife went through a really tough time, but he's turned his life around, and he's now an advocate and a speaker and goes around and does talks. But a brilliant, brilliant documentary. One of these ones that is just so hard hitting. You don't want to like it, but you end up loving it because it's just so enthralling. But a one that's hard to watch a few times, because you'll watch the start of it when you see this kid and this fresh-faced kid and how good he is and how much potential he has. And at stages during this documentary, this guy is at the bottom of the bottom. And yeah, really good show, really good show. Number three is about the great Len Bias. It chronicles the death of this guy who they said was going to be as good as Jordan.
This is like the first amazing 30 for 30. I know it's only like episode 3 or 4, but like when 30 for 30 brought this documentary out, everybody was like, this is a series of documentaries that has something a little bit different about it. Like I think probably Bill Simmons would be the first person to admit that it's like stories like this that helped make this series what it was. And this is just a fantastic watch. So for anybody who doesn't know what happens with Len Bias?
Len Bias is like, you know, just an unbelievable high school and college player, again, from really tough areas of Chicago. Was an absolute superstar in Maryland University, and, you know, was 6'7", could shoot the ball, had the high flying, could dunk. Literally, if you know, Jordan had just came into the league, I think, in 84. This guy was like, literally, they were saying, this guy's as good as Jordan. He's going to be, you know, because Jordan's star, we'll say, in 86, even though it was incredibly high, and he'd gotten 63 points against the famous Boston Celtics that year, nobody was saying at that stage Jordan is the best player in the world or anything like that. It was obviously as his career went on, but they were saying this guy is as good as Jordan when he was coming out. And you know, it's a harrowing one. It's really tough, but it basically, you know, documents his life and his profile as he rises through the ranks of college basketball, high school to college basketball. And yeah,
he dies of an overdose.
A cocaine overdose, and you know, I don't think he'd ever taken it before. And obviously, I don't know what went on that night, or was his body not able for it, or was his heart not able for it, or whatever. But yeah, to die of an overdose, and the most harrowing thing in the documentary is his father, you know, who had got his son from these areas of Chicago that we'll talk about a little sooner in my number one documentary, but. When you get him to the NBA draft night, he's selected by the Boston Celtics in 86, who've just won the World Championship with Larry Bird, Kevin McHale, Robert Parrish. Mm. You ask even how they got the number one draft that year. That's the way it was going. It's insane. And they were going to launch this Len Bias character in the top of the squad. Like they would.
But also what it meant to his family. Like this was, like I know it means that anybody who gets a professional contract.
But like for his family in Chicago, it means they're out of Chicago. Yeah. You know, it's their way out. It's the only way out in these parts. And contract signed, and you're going to be a Boston Celtic. Red Auerbach was absolutely delighted. It took him a year earlier. He was going to be able to play, and unfortunately for him, that fateful night, things went bad, and he ended up dying, which is a really tough one. So that's an unbelievable documentary in my eyes. And number two, Sky Sports, The Miracle of Medina. What can we say about
pretty that good content to work with?
Absolutely, yeah. It had everything. It had obviously looked to. You know, Severiano Ballesteros, Jose Maria, their relationship. Sevi had passed away. Jose was convinced he was looking down on him.
Seve gave Ian Poulter.
He gave him some kind of powers, yeah. And the golf, like the Ryder Cup always brings me to a standstill, but I think it brings most sports fans and obviously golf fans to a standstill when it's on. It's just intriguing, and it's getting more intriguing as the year goes on. You know, you've got the Americans now, you've got Bubba whipping up the crowd as he hits a tee shot, and you've Poulter following him up now. It's become more than golf. It's turning into a kind of a huge, just a ginormous sporting event, and that the golf that we saw on that day, and in particular from Poulter, endeared him to me forever, and just the way he literally refused to lose, and himself and McIlroy, he's playing with the best player in the world at the time, and he just hauls him over the line. He birdies the last five holes, and it's a really good one.
Right, number one. I'm interested in this because we've all seen it, but you've got a kind of a fresh angle on this.
Yeah, number one is obviously, look, it's the first of its kind, and it's why it's my all-time favourite documentary. It's why I had the video, rented the video, and went back to the video store and tried to rent another movie, and they said, hey, you still got Hoop Dreams, and oh, I lost it, it's just vanished, the dog ate it or something, but it wasn't going back to the video store. I had to open up a new account somewhere else. But yeah, Hoop Dreams is my all time favourite. It's a documentary that was made over 9 years that covers the life of two players in particular, Arthur Agee and William Gates. And you know, these guys are from, as I said, the west side of Chicago. The death rate through gun violence is the highest in the world in this area. Mm. So, you know, there's a person shot every 29 seconds or something. It's crazy what happens over there. And there's a gunshot fired every 29 seconds over there. So, you know, these two guys, it followed them all the way through. It followed AG as he went through to Marshall High School. And you know, it's a 2.5 hour documentary on these two kids that are literally, as I said earlier on, their dream is to get out of this area of Chicago and try and make the NBA, and they've got guys that they're following at the time, the likes of Isaiah Thomas, the likes of Mark Aguirre, that came from these areas and now are on multi-million dollar contracts, playing in the NBA, on TV all the time, huge names. And these guys, you know, and have nothing else going on in their day but to play basketball on the streets. And it follows them from the streets, it follows them into their home, it follows their family story. Arthur's father, Bo, Arthur Bo Agee, was a troubled character who was addicted to crack cocaine, came in and out of the documentary, was in and out of the house. It really brought you inside these people's homes. You got to follow these kids for 6 or 7 years. So incredible work. What was looking to be a 30-minute documentary ended up being a two and a half hour movie.
It's one of the best films relating to sport ever, regardless of factual or non-factual.
In
terms of documentaries, I would have it in my top two or three.
Absolutely,
sure.
Yeah. And it went all over the world, and these guys know that now. Like, you know, when I was doing my bit of research for this, I went back and looked, and these guys are talking now, and went to Australia, and whenever I mention my name over in Australian basketball circles, people know it. Japan, all over the world, you know, these two characters were known, and they never made it to the NBA, but their story and how they went, and actually a coach of mine, Russ Bradbird, he wanted me to go to college when I was 20, and he paid for flights over to Chicago, and I had a few trials in Chicago and down in New Mexico. And a guy that Russ brought to New Mexico was a guy called Sean Harrington. An incredible basketball player, an incredible person, and came back to the toughest side of Chicago to coach in this Marshall High School where Arthur Agee went, because he also went there. And Sean Harrington has a little cameo coming down the bus in Hoop Dreams. He's got a fly Adidas kind of shell suit at the time, were a big thing. You might remember Paul Gascoigne used to wear him. But he comes down the bus kind of fist pumping, and he was coaching at Marshall High School for years, doing a great job there. His car was stolen one time. He went and got a replacement off the rental car company, was driving his daughter to school, pulled up on Chicago's west side on the way to the school, and noticed two guys walking, looking back with hoods on and staring at the car, and, you know, went on to the next set of lights. They were there again. The guys turned around, opened up 15 shots, bullet shots at him and his daughter in the car. So incredibly, he saw it kind of unfold. He said he got about a second notice where he saw them reaching for the gun. And as he did that, he clicked his seatbelt and he dived across his daughter in the car. And as the bullet sprayed through the car, he saved his daughter's life. But one of them, he got a few clips here and there, but one of them pierced his back and put him in a wheelchair for life. And he's now back there coaching in a wheelchair. And when I was out in Chicago, I went to a guy called Brian Bracey and Chris Bracey. Chris had just won the league with me here with the Tralee Tigers, and his brother Brian had got drafted by the Bulls in the NBA and had played all over big leagues in Europe. And the boys' job for the 3 weeks was to get me ready for the trials, so to bring me to, you know, good runs, they call them in America, so good games. So they told me some side, they said, look, we're going to go for a drive today and you're going to maybe feel a bit intimidated at times, but don't worry. Like, Brian was known, he was drafted, obviously, in the NBA. He was driving a big Yukon Denali truck with speakers, nearly as tall as myself coming out the back, and we were boom, boom, down these streets. But when we were in the street, I started slinking down in the car because I write about it in my book. I was probably as scared as I've ever been. The lads went to the shop at one stage and I said, no, I don't want to go into the shop. And as they were in there, I started panicking, going, I'm in this car by myself.
Yeah.
Now, the windows were all tinted, but like, I'm talking about guys standing on the streets, hoods up, brown paper bags, drinking their liquor, looking really intimidating. We came to the gym. The gym was upstairs above a church. We walked up this old steel stairs. I don't know why to this day. I think Brian was giving a kid $50 to look after the Jeep at the bottom of the stairs. He said, if anybody touches the Jeep, you come up and get me. And the kid was like delighted with $50, huge money to him. And I was going up the stairs. So I was looking back. They were doing this deal with the kid to look after the car. And I went up, inexplicably opened the door to the gym. The gym door creaks open, in I go, and like, there's 40 black guys and all, they're bouncing. One, the main guy coming down the court, he just puts the ball under his arm and looks at me as if to go, where are you going? Like, it was the biggest Billy Hoyle white man can't jump story of all time.
How do you get on inside there?
We had a good five. It was me and the two lads, and we picked up two other guys, and we used to weight your game, and it's games to 21 or 15 minutes, so it's kind of timed, and there was a huge crowd in there. And it didn't start great for me. There was this guy called the Mayor, they called him. He was like 41 at the time, but he was like just an unbelievable, like Steph Curry-like shooter. Like, he's been in this gym his whole life. He's just shooting. And I'd gotten Defensive Player of the Year in Ireland, so Chris was like, you mark him. So I marked him the first few times down the court. Your man's bullying me, he's bashing. I put my forearm on him, he turns around and hits my forearm. It gives me such a fright that I back up, turns around, hits a tree, and he's talking trash to all the people down the sideline. They're all laughing at me. And it's kind of getting to the point where they're like up 6 or 7 nil, and I'm getting, you know, I'm kind of looking over to Chris going, do you want to switch this matchup up? And he was backing into me at one stage and he was hitting me hard, and when he went to hit me, I kind of got out of the way and I actually hit the ball from behind him, so he fell on his arse. Ball went out into the open floor. There was a guy in the wing. I was quick enough at the time. I was a young guy at this stage. Dribbled down left-handed, two-handed. Your man went to block me. I dunked it over him, hung onto the ring. Crowd starts going bonkers. Maybe this white boy can play a bit. And I ended up playing with the boys. We were balling. I was getting dunks, alley-oops. The rims were a small bit low when I say alley-oops. I wouldn't have been a great man to catch alley-oop. And I'd say, probably the only place I ever caught alley-oop, and I caught two of them, was in the gym that day. Probably easy for me to say, nobody can prove otherwise, but maybe Chris Bracey, we can have him on sometime.
Yeah,
he can prove it. But yeah, got that, came out, and the Mayor came up to me afterwards, like, you know, and we were after beating his team. He'd won like 3 or 4 games previous to that, and we beat them. We played for like 2 hours. He came back on another team. We beat them again. He kept coming at me. I kept going at him. I was getting confident and cocky for some reason over there, you know, because I was starting to play, I was catching dunks. I could tell the crowd had turned from laughing at me to kind of cheering me on.
You had gained their respect.
Yeah. And again, I gained his respect. And that was the best thing, as I was leaving the hall. And I actually left. He came up to me and shook my hand, and he was like, something like, white chocolate, what's up? Like, you know, that'd be a big compliment. And he was like, what are you doing here? And I was like, oh, I'm trying out for a few colleges. And he was like, yeah, you'll be fine. So I came down the stairs, I literally buzzing. I wrote in the book that we were driving back down in the Jeep, and I opened up the sunroof and I was like roaring out the window of the sunroof.
Yeah.
I was like, bring on the college guys. If I can get through Holy City and the west side of Chicago playing street ball against the Mayor and his crews, I'm gonna be okay. So, you know, when I was going through there, like, I knew that this is the area a lot of Hoop Dreams was filmed in, and a lot of the areas. So it was really, as scared as I was looking at everything. I was looking at the streets, I was looking at the corners, and it really brought me back to that Hoop Dreams documentary. And I was on my own dream of trying to get to maybe college or see the light. So yeah, it was...
Playing in front of the hill is nothing in comparison to that.
No, it really wasn't. Playing in front of the hill was fine compared to... been generally worried about your life, yeah. And as I said, when I walked in and they all stopped, you know, I didn't just stop at the door. So I turned around instead of walking down the court. There's all guys sitting. There's guys stopped playing. There's about 20 fellas sitting on this kind of like, it was like an old school gym. So like where they'd have the plays.
Yeah.
The stage, like there was a big crowd on the stage, the scoreboard and the time clock was up there. And I was walking and I just looked over my shoulder twice and the Bracey brothers hadn't come in yet. And eventually they came in and they got a bit of love from a few of the guys.
Okay.
So I was like, oh, thanks be to God.
I'm with these.
Yeah, I'm with these, yeah. So and they probably knew straight away when Brian came in that, okay, this guy is obviously not just kind of landed from Ireland, kind of going, I'm going to play.
Do you ever regret not seeing the American dream through?
I can't say I regret it because of how lucky I was in my sporting life here in Ireland, but I would have loved to have played basketball at that stage. If I did sign for college, I would have loved to have played for whatever, 23, 24 hours a week, and I would have loved them to work on my jump shot to get me in a gym. They were ahead of us at that time. Like this was 2002, you know, so 2003. So this was, 2003 maybe. And they were so far ahead on strength and conditioning at that stage that I would have loved to have given myself the chance to see where my basketball ability could have got to. And maybe looking back, I stayed for an under 21 tilt of an All-Ireland with Kerry, and I maybe regret not going for a year and doing the college for a year. Just
that might have benefited your football down the line as well.
I've no doubt it would have. I would have come back. I would have come, there would have been no kind of, oh, do your weights on a Tuesday and Thursday. This would have been weights every day, and this would have been me coming back, you know, a bit more of an animal almost, a different animal from a year over in the States. So I can't say I regret it, but I would have loved the life of a college basketball athlete, I think. Maybe not the school part, but definitely the playing every day and the games and the atmospheres and being a bit of an underdog all the time would have suited me.
Your Lakers gale is out next Thursday. We don't really have any time now to chat about it. It is worth checking out, I can assure you. Just one thing I wanted to ask you about. There's a scene in it where you're talking about winning Footballer of the Year in 2006 and you're saying you're there alongside Henry Shefflin winning Hurler of the Year. And you say that there's no way I'm actual Footballer of the Year. I might have been the most on-form Footballer of the Year. And at the same time, they're kind of knitting through some of the scores you got that year, some of the big booming points, even in 06, some of the top corner finishes in 06. And I wonder if you ever think that you were a bit harsh on yourself in terms of that appraisal of your year in 06.
I can only say how I felt, and that's what I said in the documentary, is that I was sitting there next to Henry Shefflin, where after winning a car for Player of the Year, and I wanted to get out of the way of I was standing next to Henry Shefflin, who, what I say in the documentary, I think he is a hurler of the year. You know, he is the best hurler in the country. Whereas I don't think I was the best footballer in the country. I know I wasn't the best footballer in the country, but what I said was I was maybe the most influential that four games. And it didn't sit well with me that I was standing in pictures next to Henry Shefflin. I was a bit, I know my standing, and I know, things went well for me that year, and I did take my chances well and all that, but...
But it wasn't just like some sort of random influence, some big fella who caught the ball and then laid it off all the time, like... You were scoring. You were finishing. You were like,
yeah. I could kick on my right leg. Like I had a decent right leg. Like, you know, I had no left leg. I with no dummy solos or no anything like that. I could catch and I could kick.
Yeah.
From certain areas with my right leg. But
like the goal against Armagh, for example, when you were in the keeper's face. Like, I mean, that's an unbelievable score. Like that is like a top class footballer.
I don't know what came over me for that. You know, that wasn't really. You know, maybe it was just the confidence or something. And I don't know, because I didn't have confidence that day because Francie was actually beating me for a long part of that first half. But to catch the ball at my back to goal, it would be very not like me to do a shimmy and take on my man. The only thing I was saying to him was he was on a yellow. Mm. He just picked up a yellow at the start of the second half. And that's the only reason was probably going on in my head to take this guy on. And... The goal obviously was a huge pivotal moment in that game and a huge pivotal moment in my career, really, I would say. And even, you know, even though my uncle made me apologise and I was gutted after it, and I said in my book it was my biggest mistake ever apologising, but it was, you know, that even that bit of me roaring back at Paul Hearty, you know, that was me not kind of backing down for Kerry and standing up to the Armagh onslaught, because they would give it to you verbally and physically, and I had got it for a lot of that game. And you know, that was I think Jack wrote in his book that he kind of jumped up and let out a yahoo, as he'd call it, because he, you know, that was us kind of saying, no lads, not today, we're taking this one today.
It is next Thursday on TG Cahir. As I say, final point just before we wrap up, because we meant to get to this earlier, we're going to have to be quick with this though.
Yeah.
Just a quick NBA bandwagon in each conference, one from the West, one from the East. You're going for Zion Williamson and the New Orleans Pelicans in the West.
Yeah, I think if you're going to get onto a bandwagon, I was talking to a buddy of mine, Randy Loop, who actually put us up in his house for the Super Bowl when it was on out in New Orleans. I was talking to him last week. I was like, Jesus, you must be having a good time watching these New Orleans. Mm. You know, Zion's back, and since he's come back, he's been unbelievable. He's been legit, even going at LeBron the last day. They're young, they're talented, they're high-flying, they're making a dash for the playoffs. They had no hope for the playoffs. Ja Morant was a certainty for the Rookie of the Year.
Mm.
Now the Pelicans are looking, and what a series that would be. What about the Pelicans getting to 8, and taking on the Lakers at 1? LeBron versus Zion,
his
first year. Yeah, it was amazing. It was amazing. And they've got Lonzo Ball, who's one of the best point guards in the league. He's legit top 5 defender on the point guard position, brilliant passer, he's improved his shot. They've got Josh Hart in that deal from the Lakers, they've got Drew Holiday in there, they've got Brandon Ingram, who came from the Lakers, who had kind of, they'd moulded him for 3 or 4 years. This guy's the closest thing physically to Kevin Durant we have in the league. He's not as good as Durant, don't get me wrong, but he scored 40 points this year. He scored 49 points this year in a game. He's 6'11". He can get to the basket. They got JJ Redick, who can spread the floor. And yeah, they're really exciting and a team that will be to reckon with. And I hope they make the playoffs.
JJ Redick is a great man in the video games, because he's unbelievable in virtual world of nailing the three. If you're a good enough player, as I am, I guess.
Yeah, he's unbelievable in anything. Yeah.
In the East, you're going for Miami Heat.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going for the Heat. I love what they're doing. They're under fancy this year. Jimmy Butler has been amazing. That Bam Adebayo, who was, I think, most improved last year, was an all-star this year. So he's big in the middle. They've Udonis Haslem, who's been there since they won their first ever championship with Shaq and D-Wade back in the day. So he's an unbelievable longevity in his career. They just signed Andre Iguodala.
Mm.
So he wanted out of Ja Morant's Wizards, and he got the deal. He's in Miami. He'll bring great level of experience and that to them. They've Derek Jones, who won the dunking contest, and Duncan Robinson, who's a 3-point king, and their two rookies, Kendrick Nunn and Tyler Hero, are playing unbelievable off the charts basketball. So they're a great watch in the East, and will be exciting come playoffs.
What I would say is get on these bandwagons, not just for this season, but forever, because that way, if you become a big enough fan, you've got an excuse to either go to New Orleans or go to Miami, and they're not bad places to visit. So
absolutely, I went to Boston my honeymoon, so there. That's a good. That's probably why I have a soft spot for them.
Right, make sure to keep an eye out for tomorrow's episode of The Snap, where Ger Ronan and the gang will be looking ahead to the NFL scouting combine, as well as what trades may be in store for the off season. You can watch The Snap tomorrow from 1 o'clock across all Off the Ball social channels and on OTB Sports Radio. And on the theme of American football, don't forget that our new American football newsletter, OTB Club Gridiron, is hitting mailboxes all around Ireland. Content from The Snap, podcasts, fixtures, results, snapshot vignettes, reports on games, stats and facts, early bird tickets to events, as well as both long and short form video content around all things Gridiron, will be available through membership of the club, which of course is free. Subscribe at offtheball.com/clubgridiron and enjoy all that OTB Club Gridiron has to offer. Kieran, thanks million for popping in.
No bother, man.
Enjoy the weekend. Thanks.
Yeah, you too.
That is it for OTB AM this morning. Adrian and the gang are back in tomorrow morning. I won't be in, unfortunately, but Adrian will have you covered. Off the Ball, live on the radio tonight from 7 o'clock. And don't forget Brian O'Driscoll on OTB Sports Radio, the full 45-minute chat on the disaster at Twickenham coming up from 2 o'clock. We'll chat to you later. Bye-bye for now.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.